not inappropriate for us to go to CESL, because if we go to CESL, then we must also go to the NGOs, right, who oppose any opposition, or they support the carbon tax vote. We can't be sort of one-sided. So, to alert you, when it comes to public hearings, the chairs of the committee, well, at least on our side, we don't meet with anybody. Unless they're an alliance partner that we're doing the study with. Because we don't want to be seen to be siding with anybody. And this is a public hearing, and you are free to speak your mind, and no decisions are made at a public hearing. People will express their views if they feel they want to, but those are not the views of their parties necessarily. It's exploratory at the moment. We can't preempt the outcome of the decisions we're going to make. It's very early. To also remind members, the chair of the Energy Environment Committee has requested that we have a specific workshop. Who is leading the government team? National Treasury? I can't see you. Oh, hello. Oh, yeah. So we're going to have a workshop when we come back, situation where, you know, we engage more about what you're saying as government and what the civil society and other stakeholders are saying. All right, that said, can we move on to CESL, please? Where are you? You've got up to 10 minutes, right? I'll record you with the iPhone so that we're fair to everybody. You can switch your own iPhone on so you can check when you're at 8 minutes, right? Okay, thank you very much. Or whatever phone you've got, doesn't matter. You're recording yourself. Okay, thank you. Let's go. Stopwatch. Yes, starting.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the honourable members and ladies and gentlemen. Today I'm representing CESL, and I'm going to be presenting some views on our on the proposed carbon tax and what we think would be a better solution going forward. First and foremost, I'd like to support the Booster submission as well as the industry task team in terms of what they have submitted to this committee as well as their presentations for later on. Next slide. So first and foremost, CESL is committed to supporting South Africa's transition to a low carbon, more climate resilient economy. This has been demonstrated through our many mitigation activities since 2004, as well as us actively participating with the government in the development of climate change policy. We believe it's critically important that South Africa adopts climate change policy, and we also believe that carbon pricing is an integral part of that policy regime. We do not, however, believe that the carbon tax represents that instrument. I'm now going to take you through a few slides that cover our view of what we think would be a better instrument and where we should be placing our focus. Next slide. So first and foremost, we need to understand that climate change mitigation policy must take into account the structural realities of South Africa. I want to point us to three specific issues that are highlighted by the graph and the pie chart. But effectively what it says is that we are inherently energy intensive with limited access to lower carbon alternatives. And also we have a electricity sector, a regulated electricity sector that dominates our emission profile. Now you might ask yourself why this is the case. You look at history, you look at our geography, all of these things have determined what we see here today. But it's also the reason why CESL and Eskom are in being today. Policy has been developed to direct us to using the resources we have. So it's for these reasons that we believe that the proposed carbon tax will not be effective in changing this reality. So having said that, next slide please. The thing that's also quite striking is that South Africa's realities are almost similar to that of CESL. CESL's constraints mirror that of South Africa, and to illustrate that point, I want to draw your attention to CESL's greenhouse gas emissions profile. We have three really big emission sources. The first one, indirect emissions, which is really Eskom, which is again directed through regulated policy, that being the integrated resource plan, and again an energy mix that's dictated in there. Currently highly dependent on coal, but over time carbon constraints in that policy will change that energy mix. The other big issue is that we have hard-to-mitigate emissions, process emissions, fugitive emissions, that really depend largely on chemistry, and with limited mitigation opportunities to change that profile. We've also got boiler or combustion emissions, and here we are looking extensively at gas, renewables, those are the opportunities, and that is why we have been looking so extensively for gas over the number of years. We have brought in gas. We have also exploited that gas, that current gas, and we need more gas in order to change this profile. So again, what we're seeing is a very difficult emissions profile with limited opportunities to change. And for us, a standalone carbon tax will not enable Sasol or South Africa to sustainably transition to a low carbon economy, but may in fact hinder our ability to transition. Why do I say that? We are talking about post-carbon tax not being directed at the emissions that can be mitigated. What we really have in place is a blunt instrument that really ultimately taxes every ton of CO2 with little incentive to mitigate, but really brings a very high financial burden. Which what it means for Sasol is that we actually have limited capital available for mitigation as well as for growth. Next slide. So what then is the solution that we are proposing? We are saying Sasol and South Africa needs a flexible and well-designed climate change mitigation policy that enables a just transition. To do this, we need four key things. We need an integrated climate change policy that takes into account energy policy, specifically the integrated resource plan, as well as a regional approach. Why? Because alternative energy feedstock is what we need, and therefore a regional approach is something we need to foster. Government-government partnerships, government-private partnerships. We also need correctly designed incentives that encourage alternative feedstocks, gas, renewables. We need long-term policy certainty. We also need consistency of carbon prices in the economy, of a carbon price in the economy. The current carbon tax does not demonstrate these issues. What we have is a lack of integration between the carbon tax and the budget. You have a design that taxes every ton of CO2 with little incentive to mitigate. You have no long-term view because you have a new design that is proposed post-2022. This perpetuates policy uncertainty and makes it difficult to make long-term policy decisions. And you also have varying carbon prices, which then puts us in a position where we start prioritizing more expensive mitigation over cheaper mitigation, which might be on our side. So the current carbon tax design, the standalone one, is at odds with the integrated mitigation system, which is in fact in the process of being finalized and developed. So the Department of Environmental Affairs has in fact got an integrated mitigation system that is in the process of coming through. So it's not something new that we are proposing. Next slide. So again, just to recap, what are the implications for Sasol? We have a lack of clarity on promised policy alignment. We've got both the budget and the carbon tax trying to do the same thing in the economy. We've got a tax design that maximizes costs while creating little incentive to mitigate emissions. And you've got a poorly designed offset policy that does not allow for the pursuit of least cost mitigation. For South Africa and Sasol to grow sustainably, we need a well-thought-through integrated mitigation system or strategy complemented by fit-for-purpose energy policy. So what then, Chair, is Sasol proposing? We are proposing that the carbon tax be halted and focus be placed on further refining the currently existing integrated mitigation policy. For the future, we say accelerate the development and implementation of a holistic climate change mitigation policy that takes into account energy, industrial, and economic policy, including the integrated resource plan. Ultimately, we then can create policy certainty and create uniform price in the economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The next submission, I was taken aback that you finished 3 minutes ahead of time. That's very impressive. Let's see. How do you say this? Axel Formidable. I can't say the first thing. Oh, here you are. I know you, right? You've seen S1.
Yes.
Okay. Over to you. Thank you.
So, good morning. I'll be presenting with my colleagues from Asolo Metal.
Can I just, welcome Comrade Phil Mapolani, who's the chair of the Environment Committee. Perhaps you want to say a few words? Yeah, fine. Okay. The thing is, we co-chair and we don't seek permission from each other to speak, so we butt in as necessary. But in terms of our agreement, so to speak, I will chair primarily the first half and he will chair primarily the second half. Okay? We meet again at 14:00. Right, over to you.
Chair. We will respect your time allocation, Chair, noting what you said about the detailed submission, but I just want to focus on a quick introduction and just make one key point, Chair, that I think the committee needs to consider. So the first, as a business in South Africa, I think we all need to be responsible. We need to operate in a sustainable manner. So there's no issue about the fact that we all need to be mindful about the impact we have on the environment, to operate in a sustainable manner. And the objective government seeks to achieve to address climate change is therefore not an issue at all. The only thing we need to talk about is the mechanism that is being contemplated, and in particular the bill we have as currently drafted, whether that's the appropriate mechanism, and it allows us the appropriate balance to deal with competing priorities like economic growth while we're trying to address the climate change challenges. So, Chair, I am aware that in the comments the issue of trade exposed sectors was raised, and the issue of a possible border tax or carbon border tax was raised. It looks like in the consideration an explanation is given, but I just want to highlight, Chair, that despite that and what is now included in the bill, it does not go far enough for the following reasons. So we have primary steelmaking capacity in South Africa, which is a huge advantage if we're going to have infrastructure-led growth in the country. So if you look at where we come from as an industry, we are extremely vulnerable. Over the last 3 years, we've had a surge in imports. There's a glut of oversupply of steel in the world. All of the national economies have gone and put into place protective measures. South Africa was one of the last in terms of putting in place protective measures. We now have duties in place and we have safeguards in place. Chair, with that, we're still seeing, although imports are coming down slightly, still a significant part of the consumption of steel in South Africa is driven by imports. If we then, Chair, move to a carbon tax in the way as contemplated, we are concerned that firstly we become uncompetitive insofar as imports are concerned. So we undo all the work we've been doing with government to actually protect the local industry and the sector. The second thing, Chair, is we are unable to pass on this tax to customers because in essence what we have with flat steel is a regulated pricing mechanism. So it's not legalized in terms of a NERSA regulation or law. We have an agreement with government in terms of how we price for flat steel. That then is a regulated price, and the carbon steel, impact of the carbon tax will not be able to be passed on to customers. And then this is exacerbated, Chair, with finished products that also come in and will be imported. So it will be extremely difficult to then deal with the impact of the tax. And what will result, without an appropriate mechanism to level the playing field, Chair, we are concerned that we're going to have irreversible, drastic, prejudicial consequences for the steel industry and the economy in South Africa. Chair, with that, if I can hand over to my colleague who will make some of the other points.
If we can just go to slide number 9, please. Okay, and Mohammed has already now addressed the level playing field that is absolutely important before such a price on carbon can be implemented. Next slide, please. If we look at the tax load that ArcelorMittal will be facing, it's highly disproportionate. If you look at our EBITDA figures will be significantly eroded were a carbon tax implemented in 2016 or 2017 already by just from looking at our financial figures of those years. So with that, we don't think that the current carbon tax design is sustainable for our industry. Also, what we have to look at, if ArcelorMittal were to be in a hypothetical case, and we are not, but if we were to be the best greenhouse gas performer in the world, we would still pay a tax or a carbon cost in excess of 100 million rand per annum. Now, we also need to take account of the fact that the offset allowance does not come at a zero cost. And having said that, ArcelorMittal has been a loss-making company for quite some time. If you look at our accumulated or assessed losses, they are in excess of 10 billion rand. So we will not be paying income tax within the near or medium term. In the carbon tax documents, it's also stated that one of the primary or main reasons of the tax is to fund other tax incentives, like for instance the 12L energy efficiency incentive. But These tax incentives are of no benefit to ArcelorMittal because we are not a taxpayer at this stage. So we would just be paying money into the central fiscus but not get any benefit in terms of the other tax incentives. So what we are suggesting is that loss-making companies be exempt from the carbon tax, or that accumulated tax losses to be reduced with the annual carbon tax liability. Next slide. Also, one of the iron and steel sector's main concerns is that we've got no alternative technologies available to actually reduce the emissions by the percentages desired or required. We as iron and steel makers, we rely on carbon as a reductant to reduce iron ore and to convert that into iron and steel. Yes, in the literature you will also see that there is electric arc furnace technology available, which is electricity intensive and more climate friendly from an emissions point of view. But this process depends on the availability of scrap. And to date, only 40% of the global steel demand can actually be satisfied via the less intensive electric arc furnace route. So the integrated route, which is more carbon intensive, is still absolutely necessary to supply global demand. Also, we are also not saying that we can't do anything in terms of greenhouse gas reductions, but we are quite limited. And one option, one of the low-hanging fruit options would be to make use of higher quality raw materials. Such higher quality raw materials, especially if we look at the coking coals that we need, would need to be imported. Do we really want to import raw materials for the sake of reducing emissions? I think we have to look at holistically at all the impacts. Next slide, please. In terms of the complexity of the tax, we have always raised our concerns regarding the differentiation between process emissions, energy emissions, and combustion or fugitive emissions. And we are pleading that the tax structure be made simpler, and for instance also that the allowances that are applicable to process emissions and to fugitive emissions, that they be applied to the total emissions of an emitter. Next slide, please. Okay, in terms of issue, in terms of choice that a consumer has, we have to ask ourselves, what choice does the consumer have? Can the consumer, in our case, for instance, we are a major consumer of electricity, what influence do we have on Eskom's behavior, for instance? There are also other arguments. Does the consumer have a choice when it comes to raw materials? Does the consumer really have a choice when it comes to the delivery of other services? In other jurisdictions where a price on carbon was implemented, we do find that the choice is a lot wider between fossil-based energy, for instance, and other energy sources that are available. Next slide. I think in terms of the timing of a tax, the first bullet, we refer to the emission reductions that have been accomplished already. I think we need to take note that compared to 2008 levels, for instance, we are doing very well from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective. A point that is actually more important to us also, for ArcelorMittal and the iron and steel sector in general, you will see that a huge chunk of our earnings potential will be payable as a carbon tax. But what about the other pressing environmental issues that we are facing as steelmakers? Air quality issues, water issues, will there still be enough money available for those issues? Then also what we have seen in other jurisdictions where a price on carbon was implemented is the steel industry was grandfathered. In other words, additional protectionist measures were implemented to protect the industry. And here we have to take cognizance of the fact that countries tend to boast about the fact that they are in the process or have implemented a price on carbon. But when you scrutinize the closer detail, it's actually revealed that iron and steel is exempted. If you look at Japan, for instance, they have a carbon tax that is implemented on coals. Iron and steel is exempted. If you look at China is busy implementing ETS systems. These ETS systems are not very transparent. And if you look at the literature and the media, it seems like
ETS?
Emissions trading system.
Yeah, our colleague here and his committee will understand. Can you be as simple as possible? Obligation is not enough. We're not experts on this area. We are simply politicians on our side. We deal with finance issues. Can you explain simply? Don't use acronyms that won't make sense to us. Well, it won't make sense to the chair. I can't speak for others here. Simple language, please. No acronyms. Until after you've explained what it is. Thank you.
I will try my best, Honourable Chairman. So I think the point is that in other jurisdictions where a price on carbon was implemented, the iron and steel industry enjoyed exemptions to a large degree. Then also even in the European example, free allocations were allocated to iron and steel makers, and special rebates were also still available for iron and steel makers to make provision for the pass-on effect. And in other words, so that any additional carbon costs, say from the electricity sector, which are passed on, so that they remain neutral. Next slide. Also, in terms of other concerns that we have, we are of the opinion...
You've exceeded your time by 2 minutes, my co-chair points out. So you left around us. It's not fair on others.
Okay.
You have 30 seconds left.
Thank you. Okay. I think we are of the opinion that, for instance, a carbon tax cannot be implemented on the price of diesel. We have also labored the fact that we are not in a position to pass on our carbon costs. In the carbon tax bill, it's also one sector is identified as not being able to pass on its costs. I just want to make the point again, there are many sectors that will not be able
we understand.
To
Thank
pass,
you very much.
Pass
Thank
on
you.
Their
Thank
costs.
You. Okay. Can I apologize for using my cell phone? It's not I'm being rude. Actually, I'm multitask. The problem is that it's to do with a committee matter. I'm supposed to be in Joburg tomorrow. There's need for 7 signatures. I have to be on behalf of the committee, and we'll be battling to get the signatures to book the flight. But that's Parliament for you, and there are many other administrative issues. If I don't attend to, our committee cannot function by next Tuesday. So I apologize for that, but if you want to contest me over tea time for what you said, I'll summarize for you what you said. It's fair, because you can't come here at great cost, and one of the chairs is using his SMS, okay? But it's related to my work. You can also see the SMSs. In openness and transparency, you're welcome to look at all the SMSs. They have nothing to do with my personal life. Okay. Yeah, you can have a look here. Maybe you can help me get the signature. There's 3 more to get to book the flight. For just to go to Joburg tomorrow, just tell me how Parliament works, just to go to Joburg tomorrow to address a meeting on behalf of the committee, as a committee chair on the financial sector coalition, we can't get 4 signatures. Okay, having said that, Treasury, you here, can't you just pay for the flight and then, you know, I can concentrate more. Okay, who's next? From the Parliament, where are you? Yes, can you go for it? You can sit there. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to present. My name is Robbie Lowe. I'm from a company called Promethium Carbon. Promethium has been active in the climate change space in South Africa since 2003. We've actively been involved in the development of carbon offset projects. We've actively been involved in commenting and contributing to the development of the carbon tax bill as it stands, with a specific focus on the offset part of the carbon offset. If we can have the next slide, please. I'd like to address three very brief issues, and I hope I'll be able to do it in a fraction of the 10 minutes allocated. It's a greenhouse gas mitigation imperative, what's happening internationally, and then the effectiveness of the proposed bill. If we can have the next slide, please. I put the slide in because I don't think one can talk about carbon tax without talking about climate change impacts. I however don't want to go through the detail through it, but I think it's important to frame this discussion in the context of if we want our children to have a planet to live on, we'd better do something. And with a comment, I think we can go to the next slide. This now brings us to the crux of what I'd like to say. If we look at what's been happening internationally, most countries internationally have been doing two things. The first is they've been building structures in the economy to price carbon into the economy. And that's very, very important. The world is living in a free market economy where the era of command and control approach to pollution is gone and will probably never return again. And the tool that is going to be used in the coming decades to manage the greenhouse gas emissions and to transition the world to an economy where our children can have a planet to live on, that is carbon pricing. There are various mechanisms. South Africa chose carbon tax as a mechanism. But the important thing is that all responsible countries globally are building structures in the economy to price carbon into the economy. And I think South Africa has to be in line with that. The second thing, however, is if you look at the large economies worldwide, all of them, almost without exception, has done one very important thing. And that is they have built the structures of carbon pricing in a way that during the first phase allowed large emitting companies to have a zero cost of carbon. This was done mostly through the free allocation of emission allowances under emission trading schemes. And whether you go to Europe, whether you go to the schemes in North America, or whether you go to what's been happening in China, all of them have built the schemes to allow companies to have a zero cost of carbon. And many of the comments we hear today about the potential negative impact of carbon pricing on individual companies, I think, can be addressed if we were to achieve this. The current structure of the proposed carbon tax is such that this can be achieved with very, very small modifications, but we will comment on that a bit later. Next slide, please. This is just an example of countries that have been implementing carbon pricing schemes. You can see South Africa is listed there as having a proposed carbon tax. And this is from a World Bank document that is available on the internet on the World Bank website, so I don't think we need to delve into that too deeply. If I can have the next slide, please. I've already covered this when I referred to the European Union Emission Trading Scheme, the emission trading schemes in China, the emission trading schemes in California, and also there's other schemes in North America, where the important thing is that companies, during the first phase of the implementation of the carbon pricing mechanism, was allowed to have a zero cost of carbon. Next slide, please. So if we look at the effectiveness of the carbon tax bill, first of all, maybe just a comment. I think the bill as it stands is generally very, very well structured. It allows for a fairly high price of carbon, which can put a marginal cost on your mitigation actions of 120 rand a ton, but then it allows you through the relief mechanisms to have a much lower effective price of carbon. And the fact that the bill is structured in a way that allows that differentiation, I think, is a major achievement, and that is something that we should be, I think, as South Africa, be very proud of to have structured something like that. The two impacts that I think we can talk about with the possibility of increasing the effectiveness of the proposed bill is, first of all, the bill allows for offsets to be used to reduce a company's carbon tax liability. And that, we believe, should be uncapped. At the moment, it's capped for certain sectors at 5% of your taxable emissions, and for other sectors at 10% of your taxable emissions. However, if you have bought or used an offset, then you have proved that you have reduced emissions. That's irrefutable proof that emissions have been reduced. It has been stated by National Treasury many, many times that the purpose of the carbon tax bill is to reduce emissions. Offsets actually does achieve that, and offsets should be allowed to be uncapped in order to increase the effectiveness of emission reduction. The second refers to the treatment of diesel in the bill. Initially, the relief mechanisms were to be applied to all of the emissions. However, in the recent development in the bill, the diesel was moved out of the direct carbon tax payment and moved to the fuel levies. There's two potential impacts of that. First is that you will lose visibility of the carbon tax payment on diesel, and that will then reduce the possibility that there can be behavior change, which is very important in reducing emissions. And secondly, as the proposed bill is currently structured, the carbon tax payable on emissions from the combustion of diesel is now excluded from the allowances or relief mechanisms. And we do not think that that is fair. That will increase the carbon tax liability of companies and work against the need to reduce the economic impact of carbon pricing on companies in the first phase. The next slide, please. So just as a final slide, some recommendations. We do believe that it is important that South Africa puts carbon pricing systems in place. We have been working on carbon tax for a very long period of time. So it is probably the right thing in terms of South Africa's commitment under the Paris Agreement to actually implement it. However, it should be done in a way that will not lead to the detriment of some of the major players in the South African economy. And companies should be allowed to manage their systems in a way that they can have a zero effective price of carbon. We've mentioned the carbon offsets. We think it's important that the carbon offset, the use of offsets, be uncapped. This is also very important from a socio-economic and a development perspective.
You have a minute and a half, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. And then the comment I made on the diesel, I think it's fine. And that, I thank the committee for the opportunity to present.
Association, I've never heard of this word before. What cementitious material?
Thanks, Chair. Good morning to Chair and committee members. Can get the presentation up. I'm representing the cement sector. We have five of the key major players in the country are members of our association, and the ACMP, which is the abbreviation, is also the communication partner of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. Next slide, please. Carry on. Okay. And our key worker, sorry, one back, please, the graph. Go ahead. There we are. I think this slide basically demonstrates that our members are fully committed to responding to the impacts proposed by posed by climate change. If you look at the figure, from 1999 to 2016, we've actually reduced our GHG emission intensity for cement production, and this was done proactively. And therefore, I think our members believe that we are doing sufficient work, and there are sufficient policy instruments in place, as well as our sustainable development initiatives to reduce our levels of GHG emissions. Next slide, please. So carbon tax is a policy instrument to direct mitigation action in the context of current developments. Development state of South Africa is a major concern. We believe that both the NDP as well as the INDC speaks about our developmental state as well as the economic conditions. And we are concerned that this carbon tax will actually pose an additional burden to the cement sector. Some of the key issues are there are other policy measures to give effect and make it more effective, we view, in our sector. Our readiness of our standing policies and reporting mechanisms perhaps needs to be addressed. Alignment of these policies is quite key, and I think there should be more effort around those issues. Also, sectoral benchmarks in terms of levels of mitigation achievable. We've actually demonstrated in our sector that we have reached some of the levels in terms of international benchmarks, and we could do a bit more with other policy initiatives, which we'd like to do, but there are some barriers. And then there's no certainty to carbon tax beyond 2022. And this has some concerns around future investments and technology spend. Some of the interventions we want to put in place in our facilities might cost ₹500 million, or maybe up to ₹1 billion. So this is something that we need to take note of. Next slide, please. Okay, so that's sort of a general comment. If we look at the... I think now those are the general... If you look at specific comments to the cement sector, I think it's important to note that the cost to do business will become very, very prohibitive in the cement sector. In terms of the cement industry, we are most capital intensive. If you look at it in terms of payback, we are most energy intensive of all manufacturing industries, and we are the most process intensive. More than half of our emission comes from process emission, and that's chemistry related. There's nothing we can do about that. If we want cement, we've got to use limestone, and limestone is CO2. So that's our key issues. And I think one needs to take note of these three key barriers in terms of cement production. Hence, we believe that carbon tax as a fiscal mitigation policy instrument for the cement sector may not necessarily be appropriate for its mitigation action, as the sector is continuously embracing latest technology and abatement strategies, which add significant overall cost to cement production. And I've already shown you the figure where we have reduced our GHG emission intensity from 1999 to 2016, the latest data we have. Next slide, please. So in terms of socio-economic impacts, we've done a quick analysis, and the minimum price increase of cement will go up by 2.5%. That's not taking into account other costs. We're just looking at on the plant, at the site facility level. So that will be the minimum cost, and we believe that is a bit of a problem. Infrastructure development is going to become more expensive, which is also one of our priorities in the country. And then we have trade exposure challenges. We're having a lot of cement being imported in the country, cheap cement, often dumped. Some of the countries have been designated, however, not all countries have been designated, and that's posing a problem. So in addition to the carbon tax raising the price of cement, we're going to further spread the distance between local production costs and imported cement costs. And that's a key issue that I think we need to take into account from that point of view. There is a trade exposure allowance threshold built into the carbon bill, but we believe that will not be sufficient, even if we get the maximum trade exposure allowance of 10%. Next slide, please. In terms of revenue recycling, I think the bill is speaking about electricity, and I think just that still perhaps needs to be focused on other energy sources and other technologies, and perhaps we can go into that detail a little later. Next slide, please. So some of the in terms of timing, we believe there's still quite a bit of work to be done for us to better understand the carbon tax bill in the context of the overall carbon tax or climate change mitigation approach in the country. For example, we have still not finalized the overall climate change-related legislation, the GHG reporting guidelines, the reporting mechanisms. I know we're going to be probably submitting our reports for the last year in terms of regulation manually. And cement sector, we have a concern because of it firstly being manual, it's not electronic. Secondly, the confidentiality might be compromised. It's very important that the production levels are kept confidential in terms of the Competition Commission's requirements. The carbon offset, I think here again, Robbie has spoken a bit about that. I won't repeat that. Monitoring and verification systems, I think we need a common understanding between the Department of Environment, Treasury, companies, service providers, etc. We also need adequate policy interventions are present, and I think one needs to take note of that. There's carbon budgets, pollution prevention plan, mitigation potential analysis, etc. And how does all this phase in? And I think if we did that right, perhaps there's no need for a carbon tax implementation in the first instance. There are various allowances, performance benchmark allowances, waste-related allowances. We are engaging with the National Treasury around waste allowances at the moment, so I think there's still work to be done around that. The tax formula needs to be revised, I think, in terms of the allowances, etc., in terms of our understanding. And then the emission factors, I think the factors are reflected in the bill as well as by the Department of Environment Affairs, and I think we need to just try and harmonize that approach. And then the key issue is post-2022, it's not far, and there's a lot of uncertainty that this bill provides, and I think there's a key issue in terms of future investments and way forward for the cement sector. Next slide, please. The rate of tax, I think it speaks about CPI plus 2%. We believe that initially, up to 2020 at least, there should be no tax for this period. I think let's better understand all the instruments and get harmonization. There are policy interventions in place. However, if tax were to be implemented, I think certainly there should be no increase annually in this up to 2020, so that there's some certainty around cost projection. And I think if there's going to be any increase, the last case scenario, it should never be beyond CPI. Next slide, please. In terms of recommendations, we believe that there are current national policies, plans, and mitigation strategies in place. We need to just harmonize all these policies. We need to evaluate the impact before implementing the fiscal instrument. I think there's much scope in that activity. Next slide, please. And in conclusion, I think we believe that the carbon tax bill should be deferred to provide medium-term certainty to business planning, and this will be used to assess effectiveness of these policies better and to better understand the implementation of or not of carbon tax in the future. Finally, I think I need to just thank the National Treasury. We've engaged extensively on some of the issues related to cement and waste allowances, etc., and hopefully they will bring some certainty shortly. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Over to questions. Can I just have a quick question? Is the legal resources center here? No. Okay. All right, fine. Can we move on? Questions, please, comments from members? There are no questions or comments. Jacqueline, Antonio? Any comments or questions? Any comments or questions? Sorry. Well, it's the first time I've come across this ever in a public hearing. Okay. Can I put a question to you? Have you been engaging with the National Treasury and the Department of Environment on your concerns in the preparations for bills? As you know, this is, you know, there's several gazetted versions now. Has the government shifted from where it was to where it currently is in terms of the bill before us? And are you engaging even at the moment? Because while the bill is in Parliament, I'll confer with our committee chair, co-committee chair, what we do is we encourage constant negotiations also between the parties. That means the civil society who might support the bill and those who oppose the bill and the government departments and the portfolio committees concerned. So, can you come back on that? What is it that you have achieved since the first draft of the bill or since your first negotiations with government? Obviously, they will reply at the end. Just to remind those of you who don't know, what will happen is sometime in the next quarter of the parliamentary year, we invite the National Treasury to reply to you in respect of what you have said, by which time they'll have a table. Obviously, Yanga is here. She leads the team. And then you will get a chance to reply to them, and they will reply to you, and then the committee continues to process the bill. So it's a question put to all four of you. We can go in the order that you spoke.
Thank you, Chair. I'll respond on behalf of Cecil. I think, firstly, in terms of your question, but have we had a number of engagements and so on? I think we have, and I must say that Treasury has been very open and welcoming of engagements. We've commented on a number of occasions. And in some respects, they have taken some of our comments on board. However, I think in terms of the substantive issues we've raised today, they haven't moved. and in some respects, some of the changes that have emerged over the ball have worsened some of those structural issues. We will obviously continue engaging and taking that up with them, but I think in summary that would be our answer. I don't know if my colleague wants to.
You might want to explain to the committees what has worsened, in what respect is it worse now than it was there. Obviously, worse is from your vantage point.
Yeah.
Those who support the bill will say has become better, so we understand that. But nevertheless, what exactly do you feel has gone worse?
So if you think of what we raised, Chair, and in terms of issues, these are not necessarily issues specifically in terms of the impact on Sasol per se, but it's in terms of what we believe the objective of the bill is and its ability to achieve that objective. And really, the two issues. One is the issue of uncertainty and lack of integration with the carbon budgets and the integrated mitigation system. That's an issue we've raised a number of times, and in some respects, I think the current design keeps moving further away from one that we believe can be integrated. I think the second issue is what we've raised about the multiple prices of carbon that are arising in the economy. Over time, that has become more complex and has not been simplified. And I think some of the issues raised by Promethium Carbon, initially some of those design elements in the bill would have allowed companies to get to a zero carbon. That has now disappeared. So I think in those two respects, or three respects that I've raised, we've actually gone a little bit back.
I think, Chair, just from my side, one additional issue in terms of the integrated mitigation system. So the carbon budget and the carbon tax, the one from the Department of Environmental Affairs, what we have currently in the design in this bill is that you would have the carbon tax running until 2022. We have mandatory carbon budgets coming in 2021, and you'll effectively have 2 years where you'll have an overlap of these two systems. This was previously, in various budget speeches, communicated that this would not be the case, but in this bill we do see a worsening of that situation. Thank you.
What was the time span in various speeches? Was it not 2 years? What was it then?
Sorry, Chair, I didn't...
What was the earlier time span given to you in public discourse? I mean, you said there were statements earlier that you won't have so limited time to adjust and adapt. And what you're saying it's now 2 years. What was it proposed to be before?
That there would be alignment. There would not be a situation where there would be two instruments that would be standalone. So right now we've got two standalone instruments trying to do the same thing, and you'd have 2 years where they would be unaligned. You've got mandatory.
Oh, yeah, the alignment is what you're raising.
That's what I'm raising, yes, Chair.
When you ask them about that, what did they say? They'll speak for themselves here, but what did they say from your point of view?
Well, Chair, the communication was that alignment would be achieved. This was in our previous communications. Discussions have, in fact, happened. The integrated mitigation system document, the last version that we had seen, actually achieved alignment. But this has not been transferred into various policy documents. We are still awaiting the final version, and that is what's outstanding. We now have a situation where the draft bill is put in a date where the carbon tax will run to 2022, which is in direct contradiction to the Department of Environmental Affairs carbon budget system.
Why are they doing that?
It's going to be difficult for me to answer. I'm not sure.
Why do you think they're doing that? They will speak for themselves. We want to hear both sides, as it were, right? So that, look, from the Finance Committee side, you have to be clear to us. Yes. We are not policy experts on carbon tax.
Yes.
We're going to have this workshop. This is our initial foray to calm you down, because you're probably thinking, what do these people really know? And you are right to think about it. So firstly, speaking for myself, I can't speak for others. I'm no expert.
Yeah.
I'm a mere politician. I can blabber. But what do I really know about these issues beyond what I read in the papers, right? Now, you have to understand we are not going to plunge into any decision making until we understand every comma and every full stop in the bill. We will not vote on it. Treasury knows that. The obligation is not on us to understand complex technical issues. We're not tax experts. And still less are we experts on environmental policy. Our comrades and colleagues from the committee are. And we'll take our guidance on policy issues from them. They will take guidance from us on tax issues. So this is a very initial foray. We might even have further public hearings, if need be, when we are more acclimatized, to use a word that maybe you understand better. Well, you don't necessarily understand better, the NGOs would say, but you're more familiar with, right? Now, then we will have second hearings, and if need be, we'll have third hearings. So until we understand every food stop, and if it takes 10 years to process this bill, hopefully I will not be here for very long, then the people will do take 10 years. But we're not voting on any bill that we do not fully understand. The onus is on the representatives of the public sector and the government to explain to MPs simply and clearly why a food stop is where it is and why a comma is where it is. Otherwise, they don't vote. Not in our committee, anyway. At least if the majority agrees. They don't agree, then the chair's got no choice. You know, because these are policy issues, then the chair doesn't have a say. The chair only has a say on rules. You apply the rules irrespective of what a policy issue of a party is and the constitution. But on policy issues, the chairs don't have the final say. It's the majority that decides. So to come back to the point, we will hear from Treasury. They will respond in great detail, but Yanga will say a few words now to be fair. Because you presenting your point of view, I'm sure government will have a very good answer. And so they will be heard now before you leave. The other thing we like to encourage in our committee is for people to stay, to encourage a dialogue, so that you hear the other parties instead of, you know, you coming here, making a submission, and then disappearing, and, you know, feeling, ah, well, you must hear the other side. The same applies to NGOs. You shouldn't walk away once you've had your submission. But if you can't stay, of course, business people will say they lose a lot of money. But then if the tax goes through, work it out, you business people, you lose a lot more money. So if you're interested to be here, and you can fly all the time, notwithstanding what you said, my friend, or you can take a taxi, you can be in Cape Town, you know, you can be here. Or you can connect by teleconference or WhatsApp on 408 and write, if we're on 408, as we often are, write to us. So then to remind you also in this committee, on our side at least, I'll confirm with the Environment Committee on this, we allow public submissions till the day, figuratively speaking, before we vote on a bill. If you make sense, and we haven't seen the point, and you find a comma that shouldn't be there, obviously we will take that into account. And then the bill goes to the NCOP. Can I take this opportunity to apologize for the NCOP not being here? We've agreed that we will jointly process tax bills as far as possible, Yanga. There was some miscommunication between their committee secretary and ours, and it's he said, but they are not here. But Charles De Beer did write a letter of apology. I told Comrade Mapalani about that, but they'll catch up with us. And in future, we will, as chairs, take responsibility to ensure that our committee secretaries are coordinating more. Okay, next please. Does anybody else want to ask any questions of SASOL, since they're so crucial? Declare? Anybody else? Are you a member of which committee? Which party? Sorry?
We're only inviting members, Chair. No?
Yeah, just members. For SASOL, any questions? Not at this stage, okay? People will come in later in the day as they pick up on issues. Who's next?
Chair.
Sorry, you want to say something?
Sure, with your permission, can I just answer the question you asked?
Yeah, just before that, he had his hand up. You speak for?
Sorry, Chair, I wasn't clear. I'm from the Energy Research Centre, but I was not clear whether you're inviting only members to ask questions or others too.
Yeah, we'll encourage a dialogue. You can speak in a moment. Can we have the next person that made a submission? Yeah.
Chair, with regard to the question you asked, so first on the issue of engagement, I think, Chair, it's one area that we should applaud government. We've had extensive engagement. And I think we started on this journey with the first position paper in 2010, if I'm not mistaken. So there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of engagement. So that has been done, Chair. The issue around whether changes have happened, so, Chair, if you look at the issue that I raised that is of most concern to us, and that is the issue of the level playing field, and what about the tax on imports to make sure that we don't decimate the local industry. The comment was made previously, it's been taken on board, but the solution has been some changing in the legislation in terms of the formula that you would apply. So imports are now included into the formula. It's moved from a company-based to a sector-based tax. But, Chair, the essence of the problem has not been addressed because you still have the 10% cap of an allowance that you may get. Secondly, Chair, I think the unique abnormal position both as the economy and the steel sector that we currently face, I don't think is appreciated. So the issue I was talking about in terms of the global oversupply of steel, what is happening to world markets, how other countries are responding, and the fact that we need to take steps to protect the local industry. I don't think that is appreciated or was considered when the bill was revised. The second issue, Chair, the point I made about regulated pricing. So I know a lot of discussion in the bill about regulated pricing relates to the fuel sector and the fuel industry. But by and large, for the next 5 years, for flex steel pricing, you have steel pricing in South Africa being regulated for, you know, in essence by government. Then, Chair, the last issue, and we don't think sufficient cognizance was taken of this fact, is if we then, you're still going to need steel in South Africa. So if you do then replace it with import steel that is not subject to a carbon tax, the actual net effect on the environment is actually worse, because you're now dealing with the same production costs, the same production emissions, but then the added transport emissions as well. And we don't think some of these nuances and the fact that we, in an abnormal period in terms of the steel sector as well as the economy, is being sufficiently considered.
Chair, it's Robbie from Prometheum again.
Oh, I thought you wanted to speak to me. Sorry, go ahead. Tanya's got something to say.
The steel sector must not divide government's position in relation to the regulation of steel. There was a reason why government took a decision to regulate the price of steel in South Africa. It was on the basis of cheap imports that were superseding local steel production in South Africa. So when government came with that decision, we were trying to, and when I say we, it's because I belonged to the trade family at that time, that it was important to ensure that the local steel manufacturing companies benefit more as opposed to the cheap steel that was imported in South Africa. Now, the issue that we should be discussing it's whether at what rate should you benefit incentives in relation to your carbon emission programs that the Department of Environmental Affairs has put on the table for you as a benefit if you reduce your carbon emissions. So don't bring the debate here. It's a debate that was concluded long time. And we'll come back to that issue after we've canvassed enough views on it. I hope it will be noted for further engagement. Secondly, when it relates to the cement industry, we agree with you in principle, because you see, the problem is that we've always said that some of the imports that has been coming through our shores were responsible for some of the carbon emissions that are found in South Africa. And maybe we should look at how we regulate the import of cement that is far more cheaper than the ones that has been produced in South Africa, to try and balance that. And I think the officials of the Department of Environmental Affairs who are here will have to tell us how we're going to deal with that issue moving forward. Now, in relation to Sasol, I happen to come from Heilbronn, 56 kilometers away from where you are. So the chair would have not understood the need why we wanted to visit you, to have programs that affect communities that has been affected by some of the things that happened there. You have taken over Polyfin, which used to be a plastic production unit that produced raw material for the plastic industry. We have not taxed the plastic industry to the extent that we can say we are satisfied. I'm very familiar with the activities that takes place there. But we want you to commit. We expect certain commitments, especially in the localities. You have done a lot of work in Zamdela, for instance, that we tend to appreciate. But I believe there should be discussions further. I need to hear the recommendations that you should be putting forward for us to reconsider when we move forward. Chair, I'll pause for now.
Yeah, it might be useful for people if you don't know. Tandi Tobias Kukula is the former Deputy Trade and Industry Minister, so she's more familiar with these issues than many of us. Secondly, just to clarify, I think Tandy's right, we should go and visit Cecil. It's something we can do, but not, you see, when you invited us, it was not about the effect your, or the relationship in yourself, and it was about winning us over to, actually, which is understandable, it's winning us over to saying, hey, the carbon tax bill is dangerous, not just for us as Cecil, for the country as a whole. Now, if we came to you, I'm sure Tandy will agree, then we must go to all the NGOs and hear their side. No, this is Parliament. You make your submissions here. Now, if we decide to visit you, then we'll visit everybody else. But Tandy's proposal is something we will seriously consider after we process the tax, the carbon tax, right? It's something we can keep in mind, Tebogo and Alan. On the issues that are raised, can somebody reply to them that Tandy has raised? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My name is John Taser. I'm also from Cecil. Thank you, Honourable Member, for your input. And I think we take note of the comments you've made, specifically with regard to the area within which we operate. And for that specific reason, we also believe that, as the comment made by Promethium, is that offsets can play a very important role in how we can further our role in our communities as well, specifically. So I think for that particular reason, we are asking that when we look at offsets, that offsets specifically should be flexible, and where Robbie has also indicated that it should not in any way be restricted, but that you also allowed from a company perspective, even if you are within the tax net, to be able to undertake offsets because of the fact that it is able to positively impact on the environment at the end of the day. With regard to the visit to Cecil, Chair, Honourable Chair and Honourable Member, we will take your guidance on that, and we will be in contact. Thank you.
Chair, with regard to the issues the Honourable Member has raised regarding the steel industry, if I can just perhaps clarify the position. So when we were facing the significant threat of imports, Chair, to get business ourselves together with government and labour spoke about what is needed to actually ensure the sustainability of the steel industry in South Africa, in particular the primary steel manufacturing capability. And a number of things were agreed to put us on a sustainable path, some of it related to the duties that I spoke about. And from government's perspective, Chair, the question was, if we have a local steelmaking manufacturing capability, how does it then give South Africans and South Africa an advantage? And together, Chair, we came up with the issue of how do we then manage pricing of steel into the future. And we were a willing party to that agreement and support actually that result. So when I speak about that contact resulting in effect in regulated pricing, it wasn't a complaint, it was a factual statement that it has limitations then, Chair, as to what you can do if then carbon tax is imposed over and above that. So we believe that that agreement is very necessary, that it's very necessary to make sure that as soon as economic growth in South Africa picks up and you have a vibrant steel making capacity, that we can support the industry, we can support the economy grow. So there's no issue about the agreement with government at all. It's just the limitation has been the effect of that if you impose other taxes. If I can just clarify that.
Chair, can I take a follow-up on that?
No, of course.
Yeah, if you remember when the Minister of Economic Development at that time related to the public the importance of regulating pricing, there were certain companies, well, ArcelorMittal was seen as a government proxy in a way, given the historical fact of ISCO and so on. There were people who were opposed to the regulatory framework that has been tabled that was going to benefit the local industry, but there are companies who might not necessarily be listed in South Africa or incorporated here, but who benefited from that. I want you to give us what is your take so that moving forward, there's a concrete suggestion that we can draw from your input moving forward so that I capture the essence of how then do we move forward based on what they have presented to us and want you to benefit as companies that will deal with emissions in the way they contextualize.
Okay, to respond. Yes, Chair, I think in our detailed submission and the presentation we've got concrete ideas, but on this point we're talking about, Chair, we've made the first submission is some way to ensure that there's a level playing field so that you have some sort of border tax
on steel products coming into the country. The alternative, Chair, that is not possible immediately, is some sort of exemption then for the steel industry. And we've made those statements. Chair, there are further ideas in the detailed submission that we've submitted.
Fine. Okay. Do you want to come back, Tanda? Okay.
Sure, that's fine. We'll
okay.
Work on
Let's
on.
Go on to from Team Carbon, and then finally, Associated Cementitious Material Producers, the Energy Resource Guy, once you see, and then Yanga, who has tie-up soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We've been engaging with National Treasury on the carbon tax since 2010. Overall, I think the engagement was constructive. Quite a number of the publications produced by Promethean Carbon was cited in documents such as the carbon tax policy paper and the carbon offsets policy paper. We've also submitted input into the Davis Tax Committee's work on carbon tax, and a number of our recommendations was also cited in the Davis Tax Committee report.
Okay, the final person to speak is from the Cementitious Material Producers.
Thanks, Chair. Yes, we've been engaging with the National Treasury for the past few years, and I think some of the positive outcome has been the recognition of process emissions, which we see, which was not there initially, which was good. I think in terms of cement mitigation challenges, they have now recognized some of the challenges, such as our mitigation action on waste-related GHG emissions. However, there's still work to be done around that between the Department of Environment Affairs and National Treasury, and they have agreed to discuss that matter together. And then also in terms of the performance benchmarks, they had a better understanding of what informed our performance benchmarks and how we reduced our GHG emissions trend over the last 15 to 20 years. I think in terms of some of the work that still needs to be done would be, I think, in terms of the alignment between carbon tax and carbon budget. I think in terms of the timing, we believe there are still a lot of other policy instruments and why the rush for the carbon tax regime. Trade exposure is a big issue. It was discussed a bit earlier as well. We do have very cheap imported cement dumping taking place, and there's quite a concern, particularly in the coastal areas. I think a more important issue is that many of our cement producing facilities are located in rural areas, and I think the local economic development is going to take a dent if there's going to be more imports taking place. If one just considers, for example, a cement hub in Northwest Province, Lichtenberg is where most of the cement activities take place. A lot of the economic activity is as a consequence of the cement producers' presence there. And I think we're going to see quite a knock-on effect on those issues. So I think there has to be some approach in terms of trade exposure. And then finally, I think the sectoral approach in terms of cement. Cement has been a special case. We have very little mitigation opportunities because of the chemistry. It is recognized. So how do we address the externalities that they raise around carbon tax as an instrument? Is it the right approach? Is it the right response from Treasury? And I think this is something we probably find differences. Thanks, Chair.
Second, I have a last follow-up question. Yeah, first, let me comment. This industry, the cement industry, I'm not an environmentalist, but if you look at the excavation processes that happen when you harvest limestone, you one sector that must explain to government how are you going to ensure that you deal with that in the long term. For instance, for argument's sake, the mining industry, whether mining for diamond and gold and so on, they've been excavating and leaving a deposit that they excavated underground on the top that has affected many communities. And there's been some new technologies that have been utilized to try and reuse those deposits in a way that becomes sustainable to the environment. Perhaps, I don't know, I only see one official from Environmental Affairs, the lady over there. There should be some form of engagement that should have taken place between your good selves and the department to say what are the mitigating factors of the results of that type of excavation, and you are not just leaving a small donga after you have done that. There's quite a serious effects of what happened, and we cannot be arguing from the level of economic benefits but not speak about the detrimental effects that relates to that. And I'm not suggesting by any means that more should be imposed on yourselves. I think this should be seen as an opportunity to relate to how then are you going to come with mitigating factors, given the fact that they are saying to you, if you change how you do things, there's a budget that, in a form of incentives that are going to put on the table. So to me, we need to hear more, not just the presentation that relates to issues of trade, but issues of the environmental impact of what the industry has been doing. It's too early for me to say what I would have said in an event that I had an opportunity to say it. But I'll reserve my views for now, for a later stage, because there's going to be thorough engagement. So I want to familiarize myself with how I'm going to ensure that you meet the targets that has been put for the industry moving forward, thank you. Including alternative means of production, through how you're going to diversify your products that's needed in the construction sector. That, I mean, 50 years down the line, will we still need cement for buildings for 100 years? I'm not sure. Maybe I will not be around. It might be something else. Thank
you. You can see who's our emerging expert on the carbon tax, which I anticipated. Okay, so some of those are comments for not just yourselves, but for the committee to reflect on, okay? We're not asking you to reply to everything. This is an issue for it. Okay, quickly, the energy resource person want to say something?
Thank you, Chair. I'm Professor Winkler from the Energy Research Centre. So the presentation by Cecil raised a question for me, given that I understood one of the suggestions was that there be further delay of the carbon tax. So my question through you, Chair, to them would be whether Cecil supports the precautionary principle, which I understand to mean that a lack of complete certainty is no excuse for inaction. So thank you, Chair.
Can I say anything, Cecil? Can you switch off your thank you. Yeah. Right. Very quickly,
Seth. Thank you, Chair, and through you. Thanks, Harold. I think the issue is, yes, we do. We do support the precautionary principle, and that is why we have been undertaking mitigation and implementing with government their policies. So we have a voluntary carbon budget. We are undertaking energy efficiency and have been doing so for many years. We will continue doing where we can. The mitigation that we can do, but there are limitations, and that's what we're presenting here today. We've got hard to mitigate emissions, we've got limited energy efficiency opportunities going into the future because we've exhausted them, we've actually done them. So we do sit with the challenge of what type of instrument or policy instrument would be required in order to present flexibility for us while still exploring for more gas and looking for more opportunities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted the gentleman to explain the precautionary approach principle.
Thank you, Chair. So in our national policy, the precautionary principle is stated as one of the principles, and it's also in the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which we ratified and have been a member of since 1995. And essentially what it says is that, just to read from the convention, where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty should not be used as a reason for postponing such measures, taking into account that such policies and measures to deal with climate change should be cost-effective, so just to ensure global benefits at the lowest possible cost. So the carbon tax is an instrument, in our view, of achieving a mitigation measure to achieve, and because it's a price instrument, it uses that mechanism to achieve mitigation in an efficient manner. And it's in the background. So the precautionary principle in simple terms means that even if you don't have full certainty about everything, you can't. You must still take action. And my understanding of the presentation from Cecil was that for various reasons, despite the action that Chamini pointed to, they're proposing that the carbon tax be delayed again. Now, we've had several budget speeches by finance ministers delaying the implementation of tax for several years until this year, when the finance minister said it will be implemented from the 1st of January. So that's why I asked the question. Hopefully that clarifies why. Thank you.
Fine. Yeah, let's proceed. Younger, you want to respond quickly now, or you want to come in at the end? Or I think it's nice to respond quickly because some people will not be here.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to apologize for Mr. Ismail Mamoniat. Currently, he's an acting DG. He wanted to come here, but he's an acting DG while the DG is abroad, so he couldn't come here because there were pressing issues at the office. I will respond in terms of the process of engagement in Treasury, because that is a tax legal process, and Charlene and Chris will respond in terms of the economic environmental issues. In terms of engagement with Treasury, we first published the carbon tax discussion paper in 2010, and in 2013 there was a revised draft, and in 2014 there was another paper. But the first draft bill was published in 2015 for public comments. We received the public comments, and as a result of the public comments, we changed the bill. Now we've got a second draft bill on the carbon tax based on the carbon on the public comments we received from the industry. So there was an engagement process, and we are still engaging with the industry and the parliamentary process, because before any tax bill that is passed by Parliament, it has to go through this parliamentary process. And as the Chair has said in the beginning, we don't vote on any bill, not unless Parliament understands the comma and the full stop. This is what has happened also in the previous bills. So the engagement is there, and we are still engaging with the industry in this regard. Charlene and Chris will respond the issue regarding the integration between the carbon tax and the carbon budget.
Thanks, Yanga. Good morning, honourable members, colleagues from industry who we know for a long time now. But I think just to reiterate that this has been a long consultation process on the carbon tax, and through each iteration of whether it was the policy or the bill, there have been changes. One of the big changes and one of the big policy issues was around the alignment of the carbon tax policy and the carbon budgeting instruments. So basically, the alignment between the two instruments is twofold. The carbon budget is implemented over two phases, which is 2015-2020, and it's proposed for the mandatory phase to happen from 2020 to 2021 to 2025. So the compromise solution was basically for the first phase of the carbon tax and the carbon budget, we will provide a carbon budget allowance. That means that for those companies that basically agree to report their emissions and they receive a letter from the Department of Environmental Affairs allocating them a budget, they will qualify for a 5% allowance under the carbon tax. My colleague, Mr. Cecil Morden, is here. He used to be the chief director of the tax unit, and he was heavily involved in those discussions around the alignment between the tax and the budget for the first phase. For the second phase, we've basically been in discussions with the Department of Environmental Affairs, and they can speak about it as well. So they are basically doing the mitigation approach in terms of our policy responses. And as part of that, we engaged on the options for the integration and the alignment of the carbon tax and the carbon budget for the second phase. We did a piece of work together with the World Bank looking at the options. There were a few options outlined. This paper was published in 2016, and the Department of Environmental Affairs also engaged industry on the options. So at this point, we are basically working on the alignment and looking at finalizing the best way in a high level from a principal perspective on the alignment between the two instruments. What we have been very transparent about in our documentation is that we've said that an integrated review process to assess both instruments, which is the instrument of the carbon budget even within the first phase, which is voluntary, and that will be conducted after 3 years of implementation of the carbon tax. Due to delays in the implementation of the carbon tax, which was supposed to have been implemented initially in 2015, we find ourselves in a situation where we've now gone into the second phase of the that might impact the implementation of the carbon budget. I think lastly, just to note that the first phase of the carbon budget is a voluntary phase and emissions are allocated on a business as usual basis. For the second phase, it would be expected for the mandatory carbon budget system that a methodology is developed that makes sure that the budget allocations are more stringent to ensure that we meet our targets and objectives under our climate policy and the commitments that we've made in Paris. And I think that's one of the key issues that will also inform the way in which the carbon tax and the carbon budget is aligned. We'd be happy to talk about the options because it's in a publicly available document. However, from a process perspective, we are still engaging with the Department of Environmental Affairs. And then secondly, Chair, I'm not sure if I should respond.
We'll have at least 2 hours or more when you come back to
All the, right. We'll
it'll be much briefer.
The
yeah, the Department of Environment's here. Do you want to comment on any issue quickly?
Well, I just wanted to add that there's an in-principle agreement that there's going to be alignment between the two instruments, including the second phase. There's not going to be any double penalty on the emissions, although the final details are yet to be finalized. So we're still working with Treasury to finalize the final details. There's an issue in terms of the overlaps, in terms of the timing, that is also still being discussed with National Treasury.
Yeah,
make a comment. When they're dealing with the alignment issues, I think it's going to be imperative for them to have a sector engagement. Because when you go to a stage where you're going to be stringent, they should have been taken on board. It shouldn't be a question of whether they're going to comply or not. So much engagement should happen once you have dealt with the alignment issues and you look at how you're going to deal with it. They should be on board in every process. That's what I want to suggest concretely, Chair. Because it will delay the process when it comes to us considering what they've submitted and what you'll be able to do in the immediate, especially when they make comments on the financial implications of the implementation there.
I agree with Tandy. I think it's very useful what you said. So unless people disagree with what you're saying, I think we do what you said. Okay, can we move on? It's over now to the... No, you've had enough time. It's now time. We're about 4 minutes behind time. Talking about time, I've just got an SMS from the Speaker's office to say that the opposition parties, and I'm gathering it's the DA, have now suddenly decided to oppose the sitting of this committee this afternoon. Now, in terms of the norms, if you sit in the afternoon and you exempt from a three-line whip, if opposition parties or even one opposes it, you can't go ahead. Now, the problem isn't that they're opposing it. The problem is that they had plenty of time to do it. Now, we have to reconvene after 5 o'clock because, am I right, it's a two-hour sitting.
It's because they've got nothing to say in this meeting, that's
why. And they oppose the carbon tax bill. They could have. Look, it's their right. Can we be clear? As a committee chair, speaking for myself, Fulton, it's the right, Tandy, of any opposition party to oppose it. But they had, Monday morning, this program was sent out to them. We have repeatedly been exempt from three-line whips since July 2014. They could easily have told us they won't agree to it and we would have stopped people flying in and we could have arranged for Friday morning. Although I won't be here on Friday because I've got a commitment in Johannesburg. So what we will do then is reconvene on Friday. And we hope everybody will be here. Yeah, if we have to. But there's another option I want to put which Comrade Philly agrees with. You see, firstly, COSATU is Cape Town based. If I'm correct, the legal resources, where are you? Are they Cape Town based, is that right?
No, from Durban.
They Durban?
No, Durban.
Joburg, no, so you're out.
Yeah, Durban.
Okay. Energy Institute, where are you based? Here in UCT, aren't you? Yeah. So we're going to ask you for, you can deal with the DA.
right, outside this meeting. Hopefully, if you vote for them, you're not going to vote for them, because this is how they behave, right? So, those are the things we will do. But there's another option, which is we can cut the lunchtime down to 15 minutes. It won't kill us. We can have a lunchtime of 15 minutes. Tandy, don't glare at me, right? What must I do? I'm proposing it, right? And you know you're vulnerable about eating. Let's not enter that area, right? So, when I meant that, I didn't mean it in the sense, I am also vulnerable, I'm diabetic, there's nothing to hide, it's not a crime to be diabetic, I'm type 2, and Tandy shares that similarity with me. It's not a crime, it's not a crime. Nkosi Buthelezi, you know, has been open about his diabetes, and he controls it remarkably, remarkably. Look at him, how good he looks at his age. He's very disciplined, unlike Tandy and me. So, and in that order, unlike Tandy and me, that order. But coming to the point, there's a way out. Mercifully, well, I don't mean it in a literal sense, Energy Governance SA has reported to us they won't be able to come. They think their written submission is fine, and Outer has said they won't come. So, Comrade Philip, if we behave, not least the chairpersons, or the chairperson in particular, I'm not referring to myself here, we will be able to finish by 3 o'clock. Failing which, we will reconvene after 5 for those of you who... Am I right? It's a 2-hour sitting, eh? The president speaks for 2 hours. Christian time, can somebody help us? Tandy, it's 2 hours.
I don't know. Like it's supposed to be 2 hours, but he can extend.
Yeah, say 5:15.
He might be... Yeah, but
yeah.
Let's
okay.
Make it 6 in case he doesn't...
Yeah, yeah, okay. No, well, let's just say 5:15. We will get Alan and Tebo to SMS you. Normally it's 2 hours, 2 hours, 15 minutes. It won't go up to 6. Because members have got other issues, I think study groups and whatever. So can we just say, I don't know why Dick Lady is smiling, right? You're always smiling. Okay, if you've got better ideas, tell me. Tell us, the two chairs. Okay, so here it is, right? What we are saying is, we can cut it down to 15 minutes for lunch. There are two Cape Town people we can bring in on Friday or whenever. We can discuss that at the end of the sitting. And we have removed two people have removed themselves. So we could still make it. Okay, are we agreed? Right, fine. Good, let's move on. The next then is Kosat. Kosat has moved, sorry, to the end. Oh, Kosat is actually in another public hearing.
Yeah, we just got an SMS about the vote. Is it now? Or is it
sorry?
Why do you get messages? Are we going to vote today?
No vote. But the opposition parties are objecting. Well, one of them, I'm told. Okay, then let's not go into that area now. Kosatu said they're in another public hearing, therefore they will want to come in the last session. But Matthew is Cape Town-based, he's a very reasonable guy. Industry task team on climate change, where are you? Yeah, can you go for it? Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members, and ladies and gentlemen. Please move to the next slide. The ICTCC is a voluntary association of energy-intensive and carbon-intensive organisations in South Africa. Our members contribute approximately 10% to GDP and employ over 165,000 people in South Africa. We are also a sister organisation to the Energy-Intensive User Group of South Africa. Next slide. The purpose of today's presentation is to demonstrate that a carbon tax is not needed to meet our nationally determined contributions under the Paris Agreement at this time in the prevailing national circumstances. The focus should rather be on developing an integrated and aligned emissions reduction policy and energy planning policies. Next slide, please. Slow economic growth, coupled with challenges in the electricity sector and outdated information, necessitated a review of South Africans' emissions projections into the future. The objective of the work was to establish the likely profiles of South Africa's greenhouse gas emissions relative to the Department of Environmental Affairs' peak, plateau, and decline trajectories, which inform the national determined contributions. This analysis has been peer-reviewed and was based on publicly available government data using a bottom-up approach. Next slide, please. The muted growth in emissions can be shown in this slide, which compares the updated 2010 greenhouse gas inventory and the draft 2012 greenhouse gas inventory. Sorry, I apologize, there is a label missing there that will be corrected, but the emissions in 2012 are stated at 519 million tons. Next slide. South Africa has seen a significant increase in the price of electricity over the years. This is partly due to increased efficiencies, as well as the price increases, own generation initiatives by members and grid defection. These have all contributed to decreased demand and sales, especially through the industrial sectors. Electricity sales volumes are 14% below 2011 levels, and it's unlikely that electricity demand will reach levels that we've seen in 2017. Next slide, please. In addition to the depressed electricity sales, there has also been the projected economic growth has not materialized. Next slide, please. The results shown in this slide show muted growth across the whole of the economy and consequently muted emissions growth, which shows that we are within the peak plateau and decline trajectory until at least 2025. Next slide, please. The second graph assumes that there will be population-related growth in the transport, AFALU, and waste sectors. Apologies, Chair. AFALU is agriculture, forestry, and other land use. So limited emissions in the electricity sector, but growth in the other sectors, which still shows that we are within the PPD until at least 2025. And finally, this graph shows a very optimistic growth scenario for growth in transport, AFALU waste, and the electricity sectors, based on all the publicly available information, which shows that we are still within the peak plateau and decline trajectory until at least 2022. What these scenarios show collectively is that there is no need for a carbon tax under the current prevailing economic conditions. Next slide, please. Countries' emissions are well within the peak plateau and decline limits and are likely to remain so for the short to medium term. This allows us the carbon space until 2025, which allows sufficient time for us to achieve economic growth and develop an energy mix and price path, as well as an integrated climate change mitigation system, while still achieving South Africa's international commitments aligned to the National Determined Contribution under the Paris Agreement. Given the structure of South Africa's electricity sector, the integrated resource plan, and the carbon budget regime that's currently voluntary and will be mandatory under the Department of Environmental Affairs, are more appropriate instruments to driving the structural economic changes needed to reduce emissions. Therefore, we argue that the current focus should be on the development of integrated and aligned policy instruments rather than a carbon tax. Thank you, Chair.
That was astonishingly quick. Were you intimidated by a certain opposition party to stop? The elections are coming up shortly. You can make your decisions based on that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I need to just make the record quite clear. The fact is that these kind of decisions about attendance on three-line whips should have been discussed at the programming committee. When it's announced here as part of our program, we assume that the ANC has done its job properly and that that has happened. Clearly that was not done. And so the reasons that people have been brought here and may not be able to make presentations is clearly in the ANC court.
You don't have to be incensed.
Just a facetious remark, but actually it's not true what he said. We will talk outside this meeting. You had plenty of time to oppose it. That's a fact. And we've had...
Why did he oppose the program?
Actually, every three-line work, up till today, we've gone ahead and had. We'd never finish our program otherwise.
Leave it to us.
I withdraw what I said.
Leave it to us.
That was a facetious remark, really.
Well, fine, it's enough. What you do is wrong, and it's a fact. And we'll discuss this outside, and then I'll give you the evidence, okay? This was finalized last week. And let me put this...
Mr. Chairman, can I...
I withdrew my statement. There's no need for you to respond. There was a facetious remark.
Mr. Chairman, you are pressing presenters to stick to their allocated time, yet you are waffling and waffling on here. I'd like to suggest you proceed with this agenda.
Okay, that's all right.
You're cutting people off,
this to us.
And you're waffling on, and you're not impressing anybody in this room.
Chair,
I'm not
seeking
to impress anybody. I'm 62 years old, my friend. There's no need for me to impress anybody. 45 years in the struggle. Am I here to impress you or anybody at this age? Can we focus on the issues now? That was a facetious remark. It was not meant
Chair,
to be
Chair, can you continue and leave this?
Now we're going to continue.
Yeah.
We're dealing with the DA in SCOF, not the DA in environment. There's a complete difference between the DA in SCOF and every other DA that I know when I confer with the chairpersons of those committees. And that I can vouch for. I'm not going to continue that. So I thank you once again for using your time expeditiously. Thank you. Right. And I don't withdraw anything I said apart from my last remark. I withdraw nothing. You can do whatever you want else. Right, let's move on. Who's next? No, do whatever you want. You could have settled this matter easily. You're inconveniencing the public out there. Can we move on,
order,
please?
Order, honorable members.
Can we move on? Who's next? Right, you can go for it.
Thank you, Chair. Before I get whipped, I'll try and do this in 9 minutes if I can. Could I have the next slide, please? So the approach, and we've done a lot of research as the Energy Research Centre, and what's important is that we take a developmental approach to climate change mitigation. So it's important, I think, to recall that in the National Development Plan, the APEX priorities are reducing poverty and inequality, and for that, creating employment is absolutely essential. And so climate change mitigation, for which the carbon tax is an instrument, needs to be integrated into the socioeconomic development. Next slide, please. Also, very briefly, want to just remind us all that the science, every time it comes out, tells us that urgent action is needed, even though this is a long-term problem. I just want to pick out two things here. So what has been published from the fifth assessment report, this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which gives us a state of the knowledge assessment every few years, and says it's extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of warming, and then slightly small there, but the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees, which is a temperature goal in the Paris Agreement, is about to come out. And it's very likely going to say that it implies a transformation of our economies, our energy systems, our institutions, our behavior, and a whole lot more. So next slide, please. So as I mentioned before, we certainly from the ERC side, we welcome the statement by the Finance Minister indicated in this year's budget speech that the tax will be implemented from 1 January 2019. This is after years of deferral, and it's good to have a clear date, and we believe this represents leadership by South Africa in pricing carbon, which many speakers before me have supported. Next slide, please. So getting to the tax. One of our key messages is that we believe the design is much too complex and that a simpler design would be better. And with implementation as near as next year, the importance of a well-designed tax is absolutely crucial. So we have commented on previous version of this bill publicly, and those are on the record, as well as previous policy and discussion papers of the last decade and more. And so what do we mean by simpler? One element is that we believe there should be a full tax at the margin, and that revenues should be used for a jobs and competitiveness program, and I'll elaborate what we mean by that program briefly. The objective of the legislation is very important, and that the legislation spells out how that objective will be achieved, which we think is an important element that is missing. There is the precision of legal text, and it's very good that Treasury's drafters are here, and in our written comments we do make textual suggestions. Administrative simplicity and accuracy is very important, and then consistency of principles of operation is very good to hear. Cecil say they do support the proportionate principle amongst those. So the next slide, please. So in the current part 2 and 3, there are a whole number of allowances which we believe have no credible basis, and what do we mean by that? Firstly, the nominal tax rate, or that should rather perhaps read the effective tax rate, because the nominal tax rate is 120 rand, but everybody gets 60% off, then a whole lot of further allowances really reduce the effective tax rate to something like 6 or 12 rand per tonne of CO2. And that's clearly from many studies that we've undertaken, other research institutions, as well as Treasury's own modelling, shows that that is not enough to achieve the purpose, which is to transform our, particularly our energy economy, and reduce our emissions. It's also important, many models show that revenue recycling is crucial to overall socioeconomic benefits, and we think that revenues should rather be used to fund this jobs and competitiveness program rather than allowances being up front. We understand the allowances really being the result of a negotiation before the tax is implemented between government and industry, rather than having a clear theoretical basis. Economic theory is clear, we should tax marginal emissions, that is the most effective thing. So we propose, we do not think that parts 2 and 3 of the second draft bill should be there, and we propose an alternative in its place, the full tax at the margin. From the perspective of companies, we do think that firms will be able to claw back revenue. So the Jobs and Competitiveness Program would basically be the policy, on the policy side, what you would do, what we in modelling call revenue recycling. So as Cecil has many times told us, there's no such thing as earmarking, so there's an on-budget allocation to ensure two fundamental objectives. Assistance to poor households, and I think the question raised by an honourable member are very relevant here, so this would be revenue that would be spent in particular locations to ensure that no household is worse off, in fact that poor households are better off, so they don't pay higher energy bills, and there are many ways of doing that. We've studied, written a recent article on using carbon tax revenues to reduce poverty, and the references in the full references in the written submissions, but also to provide transitional assistance for mitigation for energy intensive firms, some of them have spoken here, against agreed plans to mitigate their emissions. If they can have the next slide too, this is just support, other than the red comments on the right, top right, the slide is from National Treasury, proposed for the World Bank's Market Readiness Partnership, which basically shows that revenues can be spent to ensure that poor households' energy bills do not increase, and some specific suggestions there. Next slide, please. So I've spoken to achieving the objective through for an adjustment mechanism. So we think a very important gap in the bill that there's no operational link of the tax to our national mitigation goal. We have a greenhouse gas emissions trajectory range in our international obligation, our so-called NDC, apologies for the acronym, that's our nationally determined contribution, which we made before Paris, and that now that we've ratified as our NDC, and that is based on our national policy in which it said that that trajectory is the benchmark against which all measures are assessed. So we believe the tax rate should be adjusted on an annual basis depending on where we find ourselves in relation to this peak plateau and decline trajectory. And we have specific, in our written submission in section 3.5, we have specifics on this, which I won't go into here. And just to mention that the tax is indeed a key domestic mitigation measure for South Africa, and all parties under the Paris Agreement have an obligation of conduct under Article 4.2 to pursue such domestic mitigation measures to achieve the objectives of the NDCs. This is just a diagrammatic representation of saying of how we would see a peak plateau and decline trajectory with a range around it, and we would basically say that if we found at a particular point our actual emissions were above that green band, then we would need, then the tax rate would need to be increased, whereas if we found ourselves below, it could be reduced. At the current levels, we'd be very surprised if we found that that we were below. Next slide, please. And then there are other important details which we elaborate on in the written proposals, but I'd only go into here very briefly. As I've mentioned already, the tax rate is very low, and we would agree with others who said we find it strange to have this cut-off in 2022. We think it should go on significantly longer, in fact, until we're sure that no further action is needed. We also think that amendments are really important in two regards, and some final clauses need attention here. There are some factors that could be reviewed on an annual basis, the rate itself, emissions factors, those are usually stable, but sometimes there can be changes to that. And in fact, looking at this adjustment measurements in respect of PPD and other changes.
And then also we think it would be good to have a final clause that would provide for every 5 years to actually look at the bill as a whole, because circumstances do change both at the national and international level. And administrative matters are also really important. Just one question that arises, would SARS audit or request further technical information if the information supplied by data providers is not fit for the purpose of the carbon tax? The level of rigor and requirements are very specific for carbon tax data, energy combustion data, greenhouse gas emissions data, and so they are very important data matters. Then there are further details, and I just want to list here that we also comment on definitions, persons, tax base, and reporting, and just point you in conclusion, final slide please, to the urgent need to have a well-designed tax from the 1st of January. That's simpler is better. Jobs and competitiveness are key, and the tax must achieve its purpose of emissions reduction, since the adjustment mechanism is essential. Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I do have to apologise. I'm one of those ones who does have to leave. I have a lecture, but my colleague is here to answer any questions.
Good. Okay, he'll answer questions and take things forward. Now, because two people have fallen away for whatever reason, Busa is on next. Thank you for being under 10 minutes. Where's Busa? Can you go for it, please?
Good afternoon, honourable chairs, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Lorraine Lotta. I'm the chair of the Busa Environmental Committee. I'm very happy to hear, Chair, about your absolute commitment to reading all the written submissions, so I can be, as a result of that, I can be briefer in my oral presentation. We have submitted a comprehensive written submission, but we would have liked to have been more concrete in our proposals. However, there were some areas of the bill where we didn't have sufficient detail to make more concrete proposals, but in the engagement that you've encouraged us to have, we will see what we can do in that regard. Sorry, next slide, please. We need to say categorically that we are in full support of a transition to a lower carbon economy. However, we believe it is absolutely imperative that such transition is undertaken in a manner that clearly does not undermine the addressing the triple challenges of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. We think it's possible to do it, but it needs to be much more explicitly dealt with. We also need to, when we look at the carbon tax, need to understand that the carbon tax is only one instrument in the national mitigation system as contemplated in the white paper, the climate change response white paper. So it's very important. Yeah.
Acoustics are not great here. It's not your fault. Could you kindly lift that slightly towards thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. We need to recognize that the carbon tax is not a standalone instrument in its own right. It's part of a holistic national mitigation system as contemplated in the climate change response white paper. It is therefore absolutely essential that it is designed and implemented with that original concept in mind. Unfortunately, we will show examples of where the bill doesn't do that. We also need to consider the need for it now, now being 1 January 2019. As colleagues have shown, Chair, we are already doing pretty well in terms of reduction and are meeting our nationally determined contribution. So let's make sure that we've got a very solid instrument here rather than Russia. Next slide, please. Chair, you will be aware in your committee particularly that policy certainty has been a key element of the reasoning of rating agencies in respect of our downgrading our sovereign rating. We think it's absolutely imperative that any instrument, that is a new legal instrument that's imported, introduced, provides policy certainty. It's one thing if we don't like it, but we need to be certain why we don't like it and what we need to do to respond to it. The challenge with this bill is that it presents a number of areas where policy certainty is not provided. You've heard about the lack of alignment between the carbon budget and the carbon tax, where there will be 2 years of double punitive measures, which from the answers from government, they are saying they do not want to do. The bill, however, does exactly what they say they don't want to do. So that, for us, is a key issue that has got to be addressed before this bill can be finalized. The other problem is that because the bill now is only going to be for a maximum on reading the various dates in the documentation, 3 to 4 years, that is a very short time horizon for businesses, and particularly businesses that are going to be significantly affected by the tax. To have a horizon which says to you, for the next 3 to 4 years, you're going to have to comply with this tax of this design, when your time horizon for new investment and capital, particularly capital allocation, to be in the region of 8 to 10 years, there's not an alignment between the reality of business decision making and what we're trying to achieve with the bill. So that is something that we think needs attention. Next slide, please. Chair, another area of significant difficulty for us is the matter of the Customs and Excise Act. We have repeatedly argued that it is not a suitable instrument to administer a tax as complex as this carbon tax is. In the previous version of the bill, there was a partial recognition that maybe the carbon tax should be dealt with slightly differently, in that they replaced the requirement for the licensing of warehouses in the previous version of the bill to a registration instrument. In this bill, unfortunately, that recognition has been removed. If you look at Schedule 3, Chair, you'll see that the provisions in respect of the amendments of the Customs Act are very light. It's our experience with environmental levies that where you've got, like the environmental levy on plastic bags, for example, it's easy to verify it. You count the plastic bags and you see how many were sold and you apply the levy. In the case of emissions to the atmosphere, that is not possible. You have to have a different approach. If we're going to use the Customs and Excise Act, we believe that we have to have a much more comprehensive, specific carbon tax section, as there is to an extent on the environmental levy on electricity. There is a recognition that it needs to be handled differently from a good. We think that needs to be done, and we think that we would much prefer to see detailed regulations on the system in regulations in terms of this bill, rather than rules of SARS. The SARS rules, Chair, I'm not sure how you guys see the rules, but we find them often not totally related to the legislation in front of them, if it's not there in the legislation. So we think that needs to be done. And Chair, the 5%, we welcome the 5%. I mean, we're not going to say we don't want it, but it is not an alignment. The National Mitigation System, of my colleagues have referred to the National Mitigation System, published last year. It's a report, it's not really a policy yet, but it has two proposals. Sorry, next slide, please. It had two proposals to deal with the alignment between the carbon budget and the carbon tax, but neither of those two, and you asked also the question, when was Treasury going to conclude this? In the budget review of 2017, they committed to concluding the alignment by the end of 2017, so we had hoped to see it in the bill. We believe that it is absolutely imperative that that alignment, to avoid the kind of problems that previous speakers have raised, it has got to be dealt with now, and we see no reason why not. I mean, if the two government departments have agreed amongst themselves that something has to be done, they've just got to sit down and do it, is our view. So we hope that that can happen. The next slide, please. Next slide. No, sorry. Yeah. Chair, the bill contains, in addition to the lack of alignment between the carbon tax and the carbon budget, there are a number of areas where the bill
is not in line with the DEA regulatory regime, which is an imperative platform for the application of the tax. So we've, in our written submission, made a number, given a number of examples of that, and we really hope that we can see complete alignment with it. Next slide. Chair, we realize that it's not necessarily part of the bill now, the implementation date. We had always understood that the implementation date would be separate from the actual promulgation of the Act. We note in the Budget Review 2018 that there is a proposal to implement the tax in January of 2019. We trust that we are still going to be engaged by the Minister on that proposal, but believe that a much more important consideration than the actual date is to get the bill right. To have, this is a complex bill. Everyone is saying that, and we're not afraid of a complex bill, but we understand the implementation challenges that it presents. And for us to be able to comply with it readily and without excessive cost, we have to understand the obligations, and the administration must be absolutely spot on. So we think that's work that needs to be done. So Chair, if I can in conclusion say we see no reason to rush implementation because our level of emissions is below where we need to be in terms of the nationally determined contribution. We think that there needs to be a clear timetable of action that needs to be completed before promulgation of the bill, even approval of the bill. We've got the regulations on trade exposure and the Z factor and the offset, all of which need to be published still for public comment and then still promulgated before the bill can enter into effect. There's a number of calculations and numbers in the bill that still require prescription. We need all of that.
10 minutes, but we'll give you some latitude in time, please, here.
Thank you, Chair. We need to have established the greenhouse gas database of the Department of Environmental Affairs, which will allow SARS to verify the greenhouse gas emission total on which the tax liability is calculated. That must be established and operationalized, which also in a manner that's aligned to the customs and excise system, and the system to manage offsets, which is still a further system that's required, must be established and operational. Chair, thank you for your attention.
This is Chamber of Mines. Are you here? Yes, can you go for it? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to Honourable Chairpersons, members of the Portfolio Committees, and colleagues at large. I think by way of introduction, they're still loading the presentation. Next slide. Next slide. Just by way of introduction, I would like to just introduce who the Chamber of Mines is. We basically a voluntary employer lobbying and advocacy organization that supports and promotes the South African mining industry. Within our member stable, we comprise of 38 major mining companies, 32 junior mining companies, and 4 associations. Next slide. Just to give an overview of the mining sector at glance, the mining industry contributes 312 billion to the GDP, which is 6.8% of the total GDP. We employ about 464,667 employees. We've contributed to about 93 billion to fixed investment, making up to 18.2% of the private sector fixed investment. We've exported 307 billion worth of output. We've paid about 5.8 billion in royalties and 16 billion in taxes. Next slide. Just by way of a preliminary observation, we want to reaffirm our commitment to support South Africa in achieving its international commitments to lowering the greenhouse gases emissions and also to implement the nationally determined contributions, and also to re-emphasize our commitment to sustainable growth of the South African economy and to responsible corporate citizenship. We are also supportive of government intent to facilitate
a transition to low carbon economy with responsible investment growth in various sectors, including the mining industry. We'd also like to mention that we've been part and parcel of the drafting of BUSA submission and therefore support the views expressed by BUSA and its member companies, including the views expressed by organizations such as the IGTCC. I think in the interest of time, what I'll do now is to hand over to my colleagues to take you through the economic assessment that was done on the bill.
If you can go to the next slide after this one. Yes. Essentially what we're saying, the basis of our argument is that in South Africa, mining is a marginal business, and that an increase in cost essentially results in the closure of some mining operations, and we've seen that particularly in the gold and the platinum sector. Also saying that we are a price-taking industry. With an increase in cost, we cannot then transfer that to the price of the final product. So what we have to do in order to adjust, we have to limit our investment, we also have to limit our, to cut jobs, and also cut on production. Go to the next slide. Here we are trying to show that mining and manufacturing are essentially the major exporting sectors in South Africa. And we're showing that mining in particular is highly correlated to what is happening in the global economy. So the correlation there is much more than what you'd find in manufacturing, because most of our output is sold in the international market. So that's why we see the correlation of 41%. If we go to the next slide, that slide essentially is showing mining industry's share in total company in CIT, that's corporate income tax. And the trajectory, as you can see, for most of the review period, we've been paying higher CIT in relation to what we contribute to GDP. In fact, even in the latest numbers, that is 2017, not shown on the graph, that's where we only see the decline in relation to that trend that we see on the chart. The next slide, please. I think let's jump that slide on assumptions and just get to the analysis. The analysis is in two parts. We have the time series analysis, which I will be presenting on, and my colleague Tafi will be doing the cost curve analysis. What essentially we are seeing there are the long-run coefficients or elasticities. And what we've assumed here, we've assumed that we know in the first phase the electricity prices, we have price neutrality on electricity. So, but what we are saying, we have simulated a situation where in 2005, the year 2000 up to 2016, the carbon tax had essentially increased electricity price by 5%. And what that does, we see that it reduces total mining output by 0.1%, reduces investment by 3.3%, profitability by 0.3%, and employment by 0.5%. So those are the long-run elasticities that we derive from the time series analysis. Then we want to see the ultimate effect then in the next graph, next table. So the table there, we see the the impact of a 5% increase in electricity prices. I won't have to explain the tables, but all these charts, these tables here, we see a reduction in output resulting from the CO2 tax. So in gold, that's the column on the left, that those are the impacts, the reduction in output due to a 5% increase in electricity. And then you also have the total. We also have a table showing what happens to jobs on the right. And the, I don't think we loaded the right presentation, we have a table as well showing what happens to investment. Everything from output to jobs, to investment, there's a decline as a result of the CO2 tax. I'll now hand over to my colleague to do the to present on the cost curve analysis.
Thanks, Chair. Morning, honourable members. What we now will look at in the next slide is the impact of the carbon tax in terms of costs. And in doing so, what we do is we look at the current cost base of the mining sector. What we know for a fact is that the carbon tax will increase the input costs of the companies. And essentially what we now do in the next two slides is just to show what the current cost base is and essentially what that will do to mining if we were to add the tax, which in turn reduces profitability. Really, that's the idea. So the narrative that we're building around is the fact that sectors grow or investment takes place in sectors, which causes them to grow because the prospect of profit is there, and the converse also holds true that in the event where there is excessive cost increases, we then see a decrease in investment and a decrease in the size of sectors. That's the narrative we're working around. So if we can have the next slide, please. A point that cannot be emphasized enough, and my colleague mentioned, is that we are a price-taking industry, and essentially we do not have an impact on the prices that we receive for our product. Next slide, please. What we have done is to look at the production costs in two industries which account for about 62% of total mining employment, and that's the gold industry as well as the platinum industry. Why it's also important also is that these two account for 79% of exports and 29% of royalties. What is unfortunate, and what you won't see on the top there, but what is regrettable, is that 69% of gold mining operations, that's what is cut off at the, on this graph there. At present, right now, when you compare the current production cost, so the all-in cost, to 2017 gold prices, what you find is 69% of gold mining operations are unprofitable or unsustainable, and that's 65% of PGM operations are also unsustainable. That will also be confirmed in the next slide. I think it might be easier to see where you see there that 69% of gold and 65% of PGM industry is not profitable. That's when you compare production costs to the current prices. So the current, the low commodity prices are having that impact on the sector. And the same applies if you look at coal, if you look at as well as the iron ore prices, the same extends to the other sectors as well. That would cover pretty much most of the majority of the industries. So the carbon tax would then further exaggerate that picture as we
see. We are close to 10 minutes, but we can give you some latitude.
All right. Thank you, Jay. The next slide then just talks to confirming a point that has been made to by some of our colleagues around the actual inflation rate that has been proposed for the carbon tax of CPI plus 2. We don't feel that for the basis of a tax, because of the tax, we don't think that there should be an automatic inflationary adjustment associated with the tax. What we are of the view is that the tax, irrespective of whatever number it comes in at, any adjustments to that tax should be firstly not automatic, so it's not an annual automatic adjustment of CPI plus 2, that's number one. But then when in the event that an adjustment to that tax is necessary, that should be done in the form of by way of, say, motivation, why the tax should be adjusted from the number. But that does not take away from our base case that we still say that the carbon tax is negative for the mining industry. And why we particularly oppose that CPI plus 2 inflation rate is when we look at even the inflation rate and input costs in the mining sector. If you can just go to the next slide. And then what we attempt to do there is build the input cost basket of the mining sector. But the results are in the next slide, if I can ask you to go there. And essentially what that shows you is that in column 5, there's selling prices of commodities for the total mining sector has essentially gone nowhere, whereas the input costs have gone up by as much as 9%. So you almost have input costs going up by times 2 that of selling prices. And the rest is, and if we look at the last column, it gives you the averages, so we take out the anomalies, but the details in the individual years. The point then being that an adjustment of to that an inflation rate that is associated to the carbon tax of CPI plus 2 would again add, call it anything from 5 to 7% on an annual basis, which given the current inflation rate and input costs in the mining sector would make the operating environment very difficult. Next slide, please. So our recommendation would be that it's kept frozen at whatever rate is then put. For now, we're working on the 120. The next slide, just to conclude, is really to say that the Chamber of Mines acknowledges the fact that carbon tax should be one of the many policy measures to address the market distortions. However, at this point, given the socio-economic and economic environment currently prevalent in the mining industry, we do not support its implementation at this stage.
You're at 12 and a half, okay? So that's too much, yeah.
Thank you.
We're going to read everything, don't worry. We've got plenty of time. We're not voting on this bill. We may not, younger, depending on how things pan out, vote on this bill for many months to come. It's quite complex. Don't raise your eyes like that. We can't process bills we don't understand, really. Okay, fine. Let me move on now. It's question time, contributions. Tandy, yes?
Chair, let me start with the Chamber of Mines. They raise an argument that there shouldn't be a tax adjustment. It shouldn't be inflation. I would like to hear what are they basing the argument on. Because they say upfront, we're a price taker, therefore in the value chain we don't control the price. But, you know, this can be a debate for another day. Because, for instance, if you want to look at input costs versus selling price, for any market, it's about your ability to make your product valuable. For instance, I used to argue that, you know, in South Africa we've got a very strange mining sector that will sell its commodity at the cheapest price when others will put them in reserves and wait for the price to go high and sell it at a better price. So it only happens in South Africa, where a commodity will be sold at the cheapest price and those who buy it put it in reserves. It even happens in the oil industry. So it's a debate for another. Can you justify why you believe that adjustments should not be inflationary? Let me move to the center. The table is very difficult to manage. To the Energy Research Center, you raise a fundamental issue. Unfortunately, the pages are not numbered that I would have wanted to relate to, about tax being marginal. And now I'm interested to know how will you suggest that for us to have an effective tax rate, at what percentage terms should we put it? I don't see the gentleman. I don't know whether my eyes are failing me. Oh, he left.
There he is, yeah. At the far left there.
Yes, Chair, if they can make a suggestion in relation to that. And then when it comes to Busa, a lot of suggestions have been made, very interesting ones. Maybe at some point the two departments will want to apply their minds on it. But one of the issues that attracted my attention, also the slides are not numbered, Chair. It's in relation to the excise duty. You raise an issue that in terms of administration to Customs and Excise Act, the registration of taxpayer must be completely aligned to the Department of Environmental Affairs to allow verification of taxable amount as contemplated. And we say in the current conjuncture, it is not the case. Now, what I'm interested in is that which tax tool then, apart from the excise duty, should be applied to implement this. And if you go to the page where you speak about potential implementation challenges, you say that we need to ensure integration with other tax legislation and ensure deductibility, but you only relate to tax treaties. You did not specifically relate to the tax tool that can be taken into account. But what I did as homework to Yanga, she says that the regulations should be there that details the procedure for the implementation of the tax. So it means in one way you are accepting it, that if they use the excise duty, then there should be regulation. I think that's your argument. Do you accept that if they do it through the excise duty, then the regulations should be in place so that it's aligned with our tax treaties? because this page is contrary to what you said in the previous page. So to me, it suggests that you accept that in the event that they do it through the excise duty, then they must put the regulations in place for how they will proceed in terms of implementation. Chair, let me pause. I did not catch your other point.
You want to speak? Any other comments? Mr. Purdon, you are worried about time. Your questions, please. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Ah, I thought you had many. You were so worried about time. We're ahead of time. Okay, Mr. Purdon will come in when he chooses to. It is right to ask questions, but he doesn't want to ask them. But we'll manage the time, Mr. Purdon. We always do. Our committee finishes on time, always. So let's move on to the next issue. Can you all respond to Tandi's questions, including Younger? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member, for the question. The basis of our argument for the inflationary adjustment or the lack of inflationary adjustment to the carbon tax rate, I think the first one is, one can maybe call it a selfish one for our industry, in the sense that, as we've shown up there, that input costs in our sector have been running at a much faster pace than selling prices. So that essentially has resulted in a situation of margin compression and a very difficult operating environment for our sector, for the mining sector. And if you remember the numbers we put up, we're talking almost double. So input costs running almost double. So to then add a variable, another cost variable that is guaranteed to increase by anything, let's say CPI plus 2, 5 to 7%, depending on where CPI lands, and that will be a guaranteed increase to input costs, we think for our sector is not, it would make the operating environment very difficult. So that's the first point. The second one, and would be a general point, is that to the best of our knowledge, and that's why we approach it to say, because it's a tax, it should not, so for example, we pay a diesel levy as well as, if I think, to the best of my knowledge, the plastic bag levy, for example. I mean, that does not have an automatic inflationary adjustment. And for that reason, that's why we felt, because of the tax, it should not be automatic that it's guaranteed to increase by that inflationary adjustment, but rather as and when the dynamics that necessitated us to price it, for example, let's say at 120 have changed, that's when a motivation to the adjustment is then made. But to make it an automatic adjustment is something that we did not feel is appropriate for the tax.
Can I have a follow-up? Yeah, I find it interesting that you juxtapose a CO2 levy to a fuel levy when the impact of CO2 is far more different from what fuel is. How do you make that comparison, really?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think it was more just the fact that it's a tax. So we could have listed any other. So it wasn't necessarily meant at what that tax is seeking to address or what the tax is for, but it was essentially to say, for example, if we were to take VAT, which has now been increased after 20-something years, again, that as it is structured, it's not automatically set to adjust by an inflationary adjustment every year. And that's essentially the point, that we're saying because of the tax, we believe that it should remain flat at that level, at whatever level it's agreed at, and it should not have an automatic inflationary adjustment. I think that's what we're contending. Not so much what the tax is or what it is seeking to address.
Chair, these are very intelligent people, and you know, he's playing monkey tricks with me. I'm going to try and put the question in another form. See, you see, no, he's a very intelligent person, he's giving me a headache. Chair, yeah, he's a very educated chair, you see, that's the problem. Chair, you see, he argues that it's because of the tax, but there's a specific detrimental effect of CO2 to the environment, and why there is this specific taxation on it, as opposed to the detrimental effect of fuel consumption, which its transportation they benefit from as the minister. I mean, really, I don't know how can I argue better to try to understand from which perspective it's trying to argue this point. But be that the case may be, I don't know if he's going to give me the answer I want, but he needs to try to convince me differently. so that I can buy into their argument. I raised an issue and it doesn't attempt to tap into it. I said it's only in South Africa where those who argue that they are press takers has never put their minds on how they're going to regulate price in terms of how they expose of their commodities. I've been holding that argument for a very long time, and none of the sectors has shown their cleverness in relation to holding their commodities to make sure that their value are higher and expose them at a time that they are competitive enough. Well, I don't know, Chair. Let me leave it at that. But I'll
right, if you reply, my friend, or friend, there's three of you there, right?
I think for a different answer, I'll hand over to my colleague, Honorable Chair.
Why are you intimidated by Chandi?
Essentially, I'll address the price-taking question. The fact that we are price takers makes it very difficult for us, essentially, it's what we presented earlier, makes it difficult for us that any increase in cost, we then transfer it to the price of the final product. And that's essentially our message. If we were to change this message, I don't think we'll be able to go back to the chamber.
From the chair, that represented the shareholders' view, and that's fine.
I'd like to stand up as I say this. There's a stranger in the house, a former chairperson of the National Council of Provinces Committee on Local Government, MEC for Local Government, Mpumalanga, Mohammed Baba. We just want to acknowledge you. Thank you very much. There's the other far end right. Now, can we move on to the other question? Right, Busa, or is it? Yeah, you go, please.
Thanks, Chair. Hilton Troller from the Energy Research Centre. I will try and answer questions for Professor Winkler's presentation. I wasn't paying attention. Sorry, Chair, it's through you. I can ask the Honourable Member to repeat the question to Professor Winkler's presentation.
Chair, this is an institution that I believe in a way is trying to agree with us and believe that in terms of how we want to implement this text, it's very marginal. But they say that it's not effective. Now, I wanted them to explain to us what will be an effective tax rate in their own opinion. Moving forward.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think in general, the Energy Research Centre, the analysis of the effect of the tax is that once you've looked at all the allowances and the thresholds, etc., the tax rate is so low that it won't achieve its primary objective, which is to either change behaviour or change consumption. So I think that's at the heart of what Professor Winkler was saying. And then he made another comment as well in his presentation where he says that the bill itself doesn't make an explicit connection between the objective of the tax and the rates which are achieved. And his presentation also points out that, that there isn't any credible evidence-based research showing the connection between the effective rates that will be achieved, the change to consumption and behaviour, and then he made a final point, and this was that the latest work coming out of the IPCC, the AR5 and the subsequent 2 degrees, 1.5 degree report, show that we are not just tinkering at the margins of industries, but that globally and locally as well, that the intention of climate change mitigation policy is to achieve a transformation of economies. So I think those four things read together, if we look at implementing this tax, and we are fully for implementing it, and we also think that we need to implement even if it's not perfect, so we can start learning, and we need to implement even if the rates are low, because we can put them up later, and we need to implement, this is also from Prof. Winkler, even if we aren't 100% certain and we're not sure, because my reading of his underlining of the precautionary principle is that if you wait until you know everything before you act, you'll never act, and that the climate change policy, both of South Africa and globally, the UNFCCC, has underlined this fact many times over. So I think that would be a summary of the question which I heard was, Prof. Winkler seemed to be saying in his presentation that we thought the tax would be ineffective. Thank you.
Can I make a last follow-up? Is it possible that the professor, at his own leisure, to measure the possibility from a 10 million ton, how we can put the price at, as part of helping us in the research work that he's able to?
To you and to others, the committee always encourages people to make further representations, because you can't answer all the questions fully in the space allocated, right? You might want to think things through as you hear other people speak later in the day. So we, Tandy, it's a very good proposal. Can I also raise something that's worrying me as a chair? I'm sure the co-chair actually agrees, because we did. You see, colleagues, until now, it's very weighted in the direction of big business, industry, and so on. We're a bit concerned that if you look at the hearings as a whole, the environmentalists, the NGO sector, those who have difficulties about the sector, business and industry is insane, is not here sufficiently enough, it's not balanced out. In fact, Comrade Mapulani was saying the same thing. We're very concerned. So what we might want to do, comrades, is to actually solicit more submissions. Now, colleagues, if you turn over your page and you'll see other stakeholders, another 14, who in fact chose not to appear here. It's a bit regrettable. Some of them would bring us enormous value. What we'd like to see is a more balanced public hearing. So something we need to think about, colleagues. Okay. Can we move on? Who's next? Musa, or is it, who's next? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. We... Sorry?
Table.
Chair, we've largely accepted that we've lost the battle to have a standalone administration law to administer the carbon tax. We would have preferred it. We think that it would have worked better. We think, for example, of the Minerals Royalty Act, which is standalone for a very specific purpose. You're able to be much more comprehensive in your approach in such an instrument. So now our concern is with making sure that the Customs and Excise Act is amended to sufficient extent.
Somebody's making noise. I can't hear him.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's not you. Somebody's talking very loud. I can't hear you because of that.
Oh, okay, I'll start again, Chair. I'm sorry. So I was saying we've largely accepted that we lost the argument in not using the carbon tax, the Customs and Excise Act, as the instrument to administer the carbon tax. But we're now, we would have preferred to have an instrument like the Minerals Royalty Act to do it, where you had the opportunity to have very comprehensive administrative requirements, particularly given the complexity of this particular proposal. So now our task, we believe, is to make sure that the Customs and Excise Act is amended to the extent that it is required to be able to make it sufficient. We've sought legal advice on the matter, and we find we are still engaging with National Treasury on it, and we have agreed to have a meeting between National Treasury, ASPIA, and SARS to be able to make a concrete proposal. We think that our challenges could be addressed if, in terms of the Carbon Tax Act, there were detailed administrative regulations that would have to be followed by SARS. None of the proposals that we would make are prohibited in terms of the Customs and Excise Act, but it must be, for example, you can't
you are required in terms of what is currently before us to license a warehouse with SARS for greenhouse gases. I mean, Chair, it's not logical. It's not physically possible. So we need to make those necessary changes. The calculations in the bill itself, it refers to allowances being, which are set out in detail in the bill. In the amendment to the Customs and Excise Act, it's proposed that such allowances will be dealt with as rebates, drawbacks, or refunds in terms of the Customs and Excise Act. That is a completely different system. And in those systems, most of the time, the taxpayer has to apply, where in the carbon tax bill, it's saying, if you're eligible, according to these criteria, you're going to get this allowance. It's a completely different mindset. So we think it needs significant work, but we think it's possible to do it. But the work is going to have to be done, otherwise it won't work. I hope I...
I'm sorry, it creates a question that I will want Chris to answer at some point, because you see, she raises the issue of the licensing of the warehouses that needs to be done to SARS. And she argues that it's not logical. And to me, it's also not very clear how does it then reflect to that, because there should be a different department altogether that administer the licensing of warehouses. You will have looked at proceeds that relates to what comes from this. I'm not trying to contradict any policy that might be in place, but to clear my mind in relation to how that is reflected in the current conjunction.
What is worth, Tandy, I noted it in my own notes. Some of these things, Chris, you'll reply at the end, so given the time situation, I'm not sure how much you can do, but you'll certainly come back and reply. But Tandy's right. I also sort of signal that you need to reply to that. Then we will have whoever's next, which is Chamber of Mines. Oh, you're done. Sorry, yeah.
Pressing from the other side. I thank you, Chair. You know, I've been listening very attentively since this morning, and the message that comes across, I know that we're not yet done, but the message that comes across from key stakeholders, business, is that they don't like the carbon tax bill as currently formulated. And I've been trying to get alternatives, and there's none coming up. Even some of the recommendations and the proposals are advocating for the status quo. I think from Sasol, from the other, from Busa, from ArcelorMittal, that we must continue with the current instruments that we have to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm sure all of them, everybody would understand that we are facing a very serious problem. In fact, our National Development Plan talks about a just transition, that we must transition from an intensive carbon economy to a low carbon economy. And this is part of the instruments of that transition. And it looks like it's just been rejected outright. And there's no alternatives that have been proposed. And when one looks at the list here, just to buttress the point that was made by the chair, that is heavily loaded in favor of the voice that says we don't want this. It's only few who says no, we want this, this is important, this is part of us living up to our commitments that we made internationally. Because climate change requires a global effort. We have got the Paris Agreement that we have signed. It requires that we must do certain things, and these are some of the instruments that we are coming up with, and they are rejected. And we cannot continue with the status quo. And I think we need to have a conversation that says, how do we transition? How do we move away? Because in all the proposals that are submitted, there is no, I don't get a sense that we are going to move away. So I agree that we might have to have a follow-up session where we get a representative view of business, community, the NGO, the trade union movement, and everybody else, so that we can have a fair and balanced submissions to this current process of finalizing the bill. But I don't want to make a specific comment about either of the presentation, but I'm just making a general point that I'm worried that we don't seem to appreciate the need to transition. Because transition in itself requires that we must make certain sacrifices in how we're doing business. Those sacrifices have to be made in the interest of dealing with climate change. So I'm worried that that message seems not to be coming across. It's just a technical, detailed articulation which supports the view that nothing must be done. We must continue with our current processes, our current operation, our current way of doing things. There's even been a submission that in fact, the current emission shows that we are well within our peak plateau and the decline emissions trajectory, which some people may argue that we are not. So I just wanted to make that point here, but we can proceed.
Okay. Members want to respond to the chair. You can also do it in a pointed form, like in a one-page and say, I can see them nodding their heads, co-chair. So you know what? You had the opportunity to convince the co-chair, and it's very important, because although ultimately the chairs coordinate and steer, the decisions are made by majorities. Right? But if the chair of environment is raising it, we from finance have to take heed. And I share most, if not all, of what he said. So you have an opportunity to spend your time in one-page bullet points. What is it you're offering as an alternative to the current proposals? But not taking us back, as he says, to the current status quo, which you say you're not doing? Fine. Okay, next is industry task team. You want to respond to anything? Where are you? Yeah. Yeah, you've got a chance to respond. Although there weren't any questions raised, there may be other issues that others have responded to that you want to comment on.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think I would not like to respond to any of the previous questions raised, but just to the Honourable Chair. With regards to emissions being below the trajectory as envisaged and as committed by our country in terms of our global commitments. I think the work that we've done shows that from 2010 in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions inventory to 2012 that we have the draft out there, emissions are muted and we see this taking place or sustaining this trend until at least 2022 to 2025. The carbon tax, one of the objectives or one of the statements indicates that we require a reduction between 13 and 14.5% up until 2025. So the question that we ask is, at this point in time, or at this juncture, whilst our emissions are below that trajectory, why do we require this a taxing instrument or a carbon pricing instrument to drive a behaviour change that is not required? Thank you.
Quickly, in 3 to 5 minutes, you'll have plenty of time to take us further in the future session.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'll talk about the administration of the carbon tax under SARS excise. A carbon tax is an environmental tax, as we all know, and environmental taxes fall under excise taxes, and they are administered by SARS. We are talking with SARS regarding the rules, because you have to publish the rules into how to register and all that. In the instance of carbon tax, we said to BUSA that we're going to have a joint meeting with SARS so that we can iron out all the administration issues, so that when they publish the rules, the rules are published early, so there's enough time to comment on the rules. So we'll be meeting with business and SARS so that the administration issues are sorted out. I think Shani.
Chris, very briefly. Yes, yeah, very briefly. I mean, just, you know, this registering of a warehouse. I mean, it is done in other specific types of excise duties with the sugary beverage, or the health promotion levy, excuse me, and other alcohol and tobacco type of excise duties. So this isn't a new concept, especially from SARS's perspective. They're very clear that this is what they do all the time with all their excise duties, and it's a regular administrative procedure.
We can also just alert you, when we do our report, we can put certain things in. For example, that we would like within a certain space of time to ensure that Treasury meets with people of concerns about the administration of the tax and possible amendments to the regulations and so on. So we put things in the regulations and quarterly meetings with Treasury and SARS, and we ask them, what have you done about it? So some things don't go into a bill. They go into our report, and this committee is very painstakingly pursuant of what we've asked the executive to do, as you will see from many minutes of any meeting. Okay, good. Shall we move on?
Before we move on, I just wanted to remind Chris that she juxtaposed it to rebates. So as they engage, they must take that into consideration.
Okay, then we move on to PwC and Deloitte. Where are you? Ah, of course, our friend.
Thanks, Chief. Just skip straight to the next slide, please. Thanks, Alan. There are a few issues I wanted to discuss this morning. Many of them, I think, have already been touched on at this stage, but there are a few new ones. So I'll try and keep those that have already been addressed as brief as possible. Okay, but I don't think I'll take up a full 2 minutes anyway. Right. Just in terms of a few policy issues around the carbon tax design, the first issue is in relation to fuel, where we've got a couple of concerns. The one is in terms of I don't want to use the word alignment, but for lack of a better term, alignment with the vehicle emissions tax and the carbon tax. The concern is that we're actually going to have double taxation when it comes to the combustion of petrol and diesel, or emissions from the combustion of petrol and diesel, to be more specific. The vehicle emissions tax already taxes potential emissions on certain vehicles, whereas the carbon tax will actually tax those actual emissions, which will then be included in, or with the carbon tax, which will then be included in the actual fuel price itself. I've used a simple example just to illustrate the point here, but the point is that the effective vehicle emissions tax that's already there insofar as taxation of carbon is concerned is already higher than the actual carbon price that's, or the carbon tax that's actually going to be levied. So we're going to end up with a significant amount of double taxation when it comes to the taxation of emissions from the vehicles in question. Our suggestion is that you can't have both instruments. You need to pick which one you want, and our suggestion is that the vehicle emissions tax should actually be repealed when the carbon tax is actually introduced. The second issue is in relation to tax-free allowances, and I know Prometheum already raised this earlier, so I won't harp on about it. But there are two concerns here. One is that there's uncertainty or lack of clarity on how exactly the carbon tax regime will apply in the context of petrol and diesel. And the second issue being that the various allowances that are in place, or a number of those allowances, the way the legislation is currently designed, those allowances will not apply to emissions from the combustion of petrol and diesel. Next slide, please, Anne. The next aspect I want to deal with is around trade exposure, and again, you've already heard this morning, so I won't go on about it for too long. We certainly welcome the inclusion of both imports and exports into the determination of that allowance, but what it doesn't do is provide any relief from indirect scope 2 emissions for energy use. It only provides relief from direct emissions. And certain of the trade-exposed sectors will have significantly higher energy costs, potentially as a result of the introduction of the carbon tax. So that's the first concern, is that that if you're going to provide relief for trade-exposed sectors, you should also be providing them with relief from any increases in electricity prices and other energy costs as well. The second element is in relation to how the trade exposure allowance is actually determined, which will take into account now both imports and exports, and so that's welcomed, but it essentially assumes that a measure of imports and exports pre the introduction of the carbon tax will be a reasonable measure of how exposed any particular sector will be to effectively to import substitution. We suggest that that is not an accurate measure, and what you actually need to do is take into account certain qualitative factors. Why do I say that? Well, you could have sectors that are largely operating in the domestic, largely operating solely in the domestic sector at the moment, not facing significant import competition, but with the introduction of the carbon tax, that could change things dramatically. So we do suggest that you need to take into account these qualitative factors as well. Next slide, please. The next aspect is around the offset allowances. Again, Prometheum has dealt with this in significant detail, but there is no rationale for limiting that offset allowance. Offsets encourage the least cost mitigation options, and it's important to bear in mind that offsets are not free. They come at a price. You have to pay for those reductions in emissions through the offset programs. It was also the Davis Tax Committee also, I need to highlight, suggested that offsets should not be limited. Next slide. The carbon budget concerns and around the alignment of that, again, you've heard about that. The 5% allowance is not alignment. It might be recognising the existence of the carbon budget, but it certainly does not constitute alignment of the two instruments. In our view, proper alignment would entail, ultimately at least anyway, the exemption of companies that are participating in the carbon budgeting program, or as an alternative, at least setting the carbon budget as the threshold below which the carbon tax would actually not be paid at all. The second concern there, which again you've heard, is that we have no detail of the alignment of how the carbon budget and the carbon tax instruments are going to be aligned in the second phase. And that's crucial that clarity is provided, bearing in mind that we're actually impacting on investments that have long-term horizons, extremely long-term environments for that matter. The final aspects I want to deal with is in relation to some more legislative issues. The first one is in relation to the activities themselves that are actually subjected to the carbon tax. There is some uncertainty in terms of how those are to be determined in applying or in determining whether or not you are subject to the tax. So the real issue here is around aggregation and how aggregation works, if it works at all, in relation to those various activities. The second element that's of concern in the legislation is that, bizarrely, there's no geographical limitation for the emissions that are subject to the carbon tax. If you look at the way the legislation is drafted, at least in theory, and I don't know, maybe we're adopting the US approach to legislation, every company in the world would actually be subject to this, or every country in the world would actually be subject to South Africa's carbon tax the way it's drafted. Clearly that's not the intention, but even if you took South African companies who have operations outside South Africa, they would also be subject to the tax in relation to those emissions outside South Africa, not only within South Africa. So that's an issue that needs to be sorted out. The issue around linking the carbon tax rate to inflation, you've heard a number of commentators remark on that. I'm not going to comment on that in principle. The only concern we have is whether or not, if you're going to do that, whether the CPI is the appropriate inflation index you should be using. We suggest that if you're going to do that, you should be using PPI, producer price inflation, as a more appropriate index rather than consumer price inflation, bearing in mind that we're dealing with producers here, not consumers. Administration, and I've heard the responses from Treasury, at least initial responses from Treasury in relation to administration, I've heard Bruce's almost concession that they've given up the fight on administration. We haven't given up the fight on administration. We don't believe that the Customs Excise Act is the appropriate legislation under which to administer the carbon tax. We believe that, like with mining royalties, a separate carbon tax administration act should be put in place and to deal with specifics that are relevant to the carbon tax, and for the balance, generic stuff should be administered under, in terms of the Tax Administration Act, which applies to all other taxes apart from those that are regulated under Customs and Excise. The final element, which is also related to administration, is around the payment of tax itself. Now, it's currently proposed that accounts, so read returns, in, if you're talking from the point of view of other taxes, and payments would have to be made every 6 months. Well, firstly, that's not aligned with the greenhouse gas reporting regulations, which require those emissions to be reported only by the end of March of the following calendar year to which the emissions actually relate. It's not possible for companies to go and measure their emissions every 6 months as at the last day of that six-monthly period, and at that same point in time submit their returns and pay the tax. It's just it's physically impossible for it to be done in that manner. Add to that that the allowances, or some of the allowances in question, are determined on an annual basis. It's almost impossible then to also go and determine those allowances on a six-monthly basis and submit returns. Okay. And this talks to the concern around using the Customs and Excise Act as the appropriate instrument under which to administer these taxes.
You're at 10 minutes here. Thank you. You're done.
Thank you.
Who's next? Deloitte, where are you?
Thank you, Chair. I think a lot of the comments that I wanted to make has already been made, so I think if we can go to slide 6. What we want to really talk about there is potentially just a bit more detail around the thresholds of when you become subject to a carbon tax. So the slide is going to tell the story. But I think effectively what we're doing from a who becomes subject to carbon tax is effectively based on the greenhouse gas reporting requirements that must be made to the Department of Environment Affairs. Now, the thresholds are currently set at 10 megawatt thermic capacity. And the carbon tax is based on actual emissions made. And here's where the disconnect comes from. You know, we have the threshold, which is capacity-based, but we have a tax which is based on actual emissions. Now, if you look at the slide there, you'll see that if I have a threshold of 10 megawatts and I use a coal as an energy source, the emissions from that activity is roughly about 30,000 tons per annum. If I have natural gas, that drops down to roughly, 17,500 tons per annum. So quite a big disconnect. Now, I think also the interesting point is, you have a threshold for liters of marine oil used, 100,000 liters per annum. You can see the emissions there is far lower than anything else. Now, we talk about transitioning. I think shouldn't we be basing the carbon tax threshold, or when you are subject to the carbon tax, on your actual emissions? And shouldn't we be encouraging people to, for instance, if I have to use 10 megawatt thermic capacity, to move away from coal down to natural gas, which is obviously a much cleaner source? Isn't that what we should be looking from a transitional perspective and implement that, and then therefore have specific thresholds when you are subject to the carbon tax? And this specific point becomes quite problematic if you have potentially backup generators in your plant. Most of these backup generators are more than 10 megawatts thermic capacity. Therefore, you're going to be subject to carbon tax, and you might actually not actually have a lot of emissions, but you're going to still be paying the tax. You also have an issue with legal entities, whether or not this 10 megawatt thermic capacity is based on legal entity. I think it seemingly is, and it has other unintended consequences as well. And we've also worked out, even if you have renewable energy boilers, with a bigger than a 10 megawatt thermic capacity, you're also going to be subject to a carbon tax, which is obviously not what was intended with the carbon tax. If you can go to the next slide, please. Here you'll see, you know, if we're now applying the threshold on tax entities, and this is still something which is quite unclear. Yeah, you could have an entity with a couple of activities, you know, multi-divisional legal entity with lots of different activities, maybe a bakery in it, a processing plant, and all of its activities are below the threshold, yet as a legal entity it is above the threshold and will be subject to carbon tax. That entity now needs to compete against other entities who might, for whatever reason, be structured totally differently, which could have its processing plants in a separate legal entity where it will be below the threshold. So there's a couple of unintended consequences there from a competition perspective. And then lastly, I would like to just talk about revenue recycling, and I think if we can go to slide number 12. Specifically, we talk about section 12L. Section 12L is an income tax deduction which allows companies or taxpayers who are more energy efficient to claim a tax deduction on that energy efficiency that has been achieved. And in many documentation, it's shown as a counterbalance to the effect of the carbon tax. From what we understand, during 2016, it was recorded that about 5.9 million megawatts hours of energy has been saved. If we then apply the tax rate, or the allowance rate of 45 cents per kilowatt hour on that, you get to a tax allowances that has been claimed of 2.6 billion rand for that specific year. If we now think about what that costs National Treasury, or the loss of the fiscus, is effectively the after-tax value of it, which is 28% of the allowance, which comes down to about 750 million rand. Now that's for 1 year. If we now think about, if we then estimate what it would be, what is our revenue loss from Section 12L over its lifetime, it's probably going to be between 1 billion and 3 billion rand over its lifetime. And remember, this has got a lifetime up until 2020. It's not yet been proposed that it will continue after that, and carbon tax is going to be continuing after that. It means that from a revenue recycling, and this is what the main instrument for revenue recycling, it will be recouped within 6 months of a carbon tax. So there's not really revenue recycling happening at this point in time. And I think from that perspective, one has to look at, you know, other instruments to also encourage people to change behavior, to make the transition. The tax could be one instrument that needs to be imposed, but there surely must be other incentives as well for people to change behavior. I think on that note, that's all for me. Thank you, Chair.
Next then is the Energy Institute, Professor Lloyd. Go for it, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've seen this as my viewpoint as a nutty professor to go right away back to square one and look at the basic fundamentals of this.
He speaks very fast. He speaks very fast. I'm not going to hear him.
Sorry? Professor?
Yes, sir.
This may well be one of your former students, Tandi Tobias. So it's a reflection on you. She says you're speaking too fast already.
Well, I'm trying to make the 10 minutes, the 10 minutes, sir.
No, look, we've got latitude. Actually,
right,
we're astonishingly ahead of time.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. The brief outline is that I'm going to be talking about global warming. I'm going to be talking about the significance of the impacts arising from global warming. I'm going to be talking about what the carbon tax hopes to achieve and what it actually is likely to achieve. We have the next slide, which is just an introduction to global warming, and then the one after that. Is it significant? Now, this curve that will appear shows the official record of what we're supposed to be so worried about. That is global warming. You can't really read the axis on the left-hand side, but it goes from about minus 0.4 degrees centigrade up to about plus 0.6 degrees centigrade. It's about a degree centigrade move over the last century and a bit. This curve is a fault. I will show you its white fault in a moment. This is the official curve driving the whole of the global warming story. If you can have a look at the next slide, one of the things I want to do is to ask about whether it is significant. Now the red curve, oops, we've gone too far. The red curve on that thing shows the average summer temperature, the average daytime temperature throughout the year from January through back to December at the end going through winter. The blue curve shows the average winter temperature, the average nighttime temperature. The green curve in the center, which you can hardly see, represents the average temperature. Over the green curve, you can see a wiggly black line. It's the same line as the one up top. All that has happened is that I've put it on the same scale as the climate of Cape Town. You can hardly see it. You have to ask if that is significant, because that is the whole basis of global warming. You can hardly see it when you look at it in terms of our known climate. We get to the next slide. Is it significant? As I said, that the data have actually been corrupted. This is the data for Cape Town's average temperature, in green, that we sent to the Americans. The red curve is what they did to it. They abandoned everything before 1910. Between 1910 and 1940, they reduced our data by 1.2 degrees centigrade. And lo and behold, we show for the last 150 years that Cape Town's temperature has gone down. That's our official records. They have corrupted our official records to show that it's warmed by 1.2 degrees centigrade. Now, you have to ask why on earth that has happened. I've asked the question, why on earth did you do that? They said, oh, well, you see, in 1960 you moved the temperature recording place from the observatory to the airport. I said, but hang on a moment, you don't know Cape Town. Observatory is cooler than the airport, not warmer. You've moved it the wrong way. That's how bad it is, and I can show you at least 1,000 cities around the world where the Americans have done this to the basic data that they were given. So, it's a big, big problem. If we go to the next slide, this addresses the thing that, you know, am I really a nutcase? You know, haven't you heard that 97% of all scientists agree with the consensus? The simple fact of the matter is that a very simple, straightforward question carried out by a large German institution said, how convinced are you that climate change, whether natural or anthropogenic, is occurring now? 79% of all scientists were convinced that there was global warming going on. The next question was, how convinced are you that most of the recent or near future climate change is or will be the result of anthropogenic causes? And only 47% were convinced. So I'm one of the more than 50% of scientists who've got some doubt about the thesis. Can we go on to the next one? How strong is the evidence for impacts? Importantly, since 2010, when we started on this exercise of a carbon tax, there's been developments in the science. One of the developments in the science is a thing called, from the IPCC, called the Special Report on Extreme Events. It's absolutely fascinating what it says. Let's move on to the next slide. Global warming. It's fairly clear that there is global warming taking place. Amongst others, glaciers are retreating. But the interesting thing about glaciers are retreating are that as they retreat, they reveal that there are paths over the Alpine passes that were covered up by the glaciers. And those paths were last used 800 years ago. So for 800 years, the glaciers have been growing, they're now shrinking back. It's a fairly natural phenomenon we're observing. Is it due to global warming? We don't know. The days are warmer on average, but that's what you would expect. The Arctic has got less ice. The interesting thing is that there's growing evidence that the Arctic ice is cyclic in its performance, and the Antarctic has grown more ice. The total amount of sea ice around the world is the same. We go to the next slide. Droughts and floods. As I said, the IPCC produced a special report on extreme events, and it said there is medium confidence that the length of warm spells and heat waves has increased since the middle of the last century. That's global warming. We know that there is warming taking place. But there's very low confidence that any observed long-term increases in tropical cyclone activity is robust. Tropical cyclones are not getting worse. There's low confidence in observed trends on small-scale phenomena such as tornadoes and hail storms. But what the really interesting one is that there is limited to medium evidence available to assess the observed changes in floods. There's low agreement in this evidence, and there's thus low overall confidence in the global scale regarding even the sign of floods. We don't know if floods are getting better or worse. If we turn on to the next slide, winds and storms. one of the things that they worry about is the fact that there's no competence whatsoever in projections and changes in extreme winds. We don't know whether winds are going to get any worse. There's medium competence that droughts will intensify in the 21st century in some seasons and in some areas. But they can't tell which ones are which, and it keeps on changing as to whether the droughts are more intense or less intense. They conclude this particular section by saying, uncertainty in projections of changes in large-scale patterns of natural climate remains very large. There's very large uncertainty about whether there are any changes in the climate patterns that we observe. Now I'd like to move on to something completely different. And this is something where I actually get very cross, because it's an example of what I call OECD colonialism. Can we have the next slide, please? And that is malaria. For some time, the IPCC has been banging on about malaria. From results of predictive model studies, there's medium to high competence that under climate change scenarios, there will be a net increase in the range of malaria. That's nonsense. You want to know why it's nonsense? You only have to look at the evidence that one of the worst malaria catastrophes recorded on this planet occurred in 1923, when 30,000 cases of malaria occurred, and there were 10,000 deaths at Archangel on the brink of the Arctic Circle. Temperature doesn't play a role in the spread of malaria, and yet the IPCC is diverting resources into saying that it does. What is worse is that the US, for instance, and many other countries, firebomb malaria out of existence. We can't firebomb malaria out of existence. We're not allowed to. We're given bed nets. And you know the effect of those bed nets? Over 1 million children die from malaria every year, 90% of them living in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, do you understand what I mean when I say OECD colonialism? Don't do as we have done, do as we say you should do. And it's exactly the same with climate change. Sea level, if you can look at the next one. There's this panic about sea level, but in fact, if you look at the records, and here on the right-hand side is a record of Wismar on the Baltic, and I've chosen it because it's about as neutral a site as you can wish to imagine. It has been growing at approximately 1.5 millimeters per year for over nearly 200 years in this particular record. One of the reasons why I chose it, because it is so long. There's no sign of any changes due to temperature changes and things like that. There have been rapid increases in carbon dioxide in the air. They haven't affected the sea level in the least. There's some fairly strong recent evidence that things like the sea temperature haven't changed in the least. Sea temperature has got nothing to do with sea level. This is purely a geographic phenomenon, and it's been going on for a very long time. I can show you the record going back some 20,000 years, but that is overkill. I think from what I've said, you will understand that we have great difficulties in finding out what the impacts actually are. And the evidence is that the impacts are much, much less than we're led to believe by regular newspaper stories. Let's now look at what a carbon tax hopes to achieve. It is based on Bigovian tax theory, and the tax theory quite clearly. The Bigovian taxes are intended to correct an inefficient market outcome by being set equal to the social cost of negative externalities. The negative externalities result in the social cost of a market activity not being covered by the private cost of that activity. You pay something for a lump of coal, you burn that lump of coal and get some benefit, but there could be some costs associated with burning the coal that are not taken into account in its price. In such a case, the market outcome is inefficient. If we go to the next slide, then applying that theory to the carbon emissions, the big problem, the big challenge is to try and determine what the social cost of negative externalities might be. But the trouble is that if you go into the literatures, I've just taken you very quickly through, very, very few of the putative social costs are quantifiable. We've got no idea whether they're reliable. We have no idea what's happening to the climate. We're very, very uncertain about that, even though the world has been warming for 150 years. As in the majority of cases, it's not even possible to calculate a defensible estimate of the future costs. There have been a number of attempts. One of the famous ones was that of Lord Stern, and somebody reported on that, who wants to insure their great-great-grandchildren against something that might conceptually happen in 200 years' time? Would you? I wouldn't. So there is no basis.
Professor, can you round up in the next minute, please?
Sorry?
Can you round up, please, in the next minute?
There's no basis for negative externalities, so there's no basis for carbon tax. It can't achieve anything in South Africa other than to, because there is no social cost associated with it, then we're fairly certain that you can't justify a Pigovian tax of this kind. I've got to ask why we should suffer from the world. If you look at the actual carbon emissions of this century, you find that China has screeched up its carbon emissions and has grown. The department says that we should take a fair thing, and I ask, what is fair? I don't believe that we can possibly fair when we've been controlling in this century our emissions at practically flat. Therefore, I would conclude that we must reject this carbon tax outright. Its fundamentals are wrong.
Thank you. If it's of any consolation, the big business was beaming while you were speaking. Can we move on to Paper Manufacturers Association? Paper Manufacturers
Chair, Association. Chair, you know I'm not that intelligent. If you take too many presentations, my mind's going to block.
You have to manage things because you know what's happened. A certain party that doesn't mention to oppose this thing, now we're in this mess. So, but we've been fine. We will finish by 3 o'clock if all goes well.
I don't remember everything you know.
Yeah, but please, Tandy, bear with me. Speak to the persons concerned who are responsible for this. You can do that outside this meeting. Let's move on to the Paper Manufacturers Association. Thank you, Chair.
Well, I'm honoured to be going after the professor. Unfortunately, I don't believe the same way he does, so we have to do something about this. PAMSA does support the transition to a low-carbon economy. And the contribution by the pulp and paper industry to low emissions, we're actually a low emission contributor, only 0.8%. By comparison, the rest of the energy sector contributes 83%, of which we know 47% is by Eskom. Next slide. We involved with combined heat and power, and we burn biomass, so our emissions are obviously lower. Next slide. If you take a look at this slide, you can see the importance of forests and of planted forests, plantations, and just how much carbon they actually store per square meter. If you look at the next slide, and you look at the third column next to commercial small grower afforestation, if we had that 100,000 hectares that was discussed and agreed when we signed the BBBEE transformation charter for our sector, I think we have planted only about 12,000 of that 100,000 hectares. But if those 100,000 hectares were planted, we would sequester or store an additional 4.58 million tonnes of carbon over the next, well, over 7 to 11 years when that was planted. Okay, next slide. I'll comment on the actual carbon tax bill, and I must just compliment whoever printed all of these documents. I have to tell you that there's a half-life for paper and CO2 stored in the paper, and our recycling levels are at 68%, so I just have to give you that little punch. So you can all please recycle the paper. It's all locally produced. All right. Here, this was actually mentioned, and by Deloitte, the issue of the 10 megawatt threshold. In our sector, we do have a little bit of a problem because if you convert paper into corrugated board and make boxes and you vertically integrate it, you fall into a different sector, but you compete with people in the companies in the same sector. So you can come up with a little bit of an issue. If you go to the next slide, so if you're small, you would have a cost competitive advantage. You're not going to be paying carbon tax, but it's the same issue that Deloitte discussed. Next slide. This is just a comment on the actual formula. We are very pleased that there is an S in there and that you can deduct the carbon that has been stored, and in plantations or by other means. But what we are suggesting is that you would be allowed to actually drop below zero. And what I mean by this is that, and I understand why National Treasury doesn't want it, because they wouldn't like to have to pay us for storing the carbon. But if you bear with me, I'll explain to you why. We move on to the next slide. Planting trees is obviously something that we do, and there are a whole lot of vagaries. You have pests, you have diseases, you have fires, you can have your entire plantation moved, burnt down. And then what you would have to do is you would have to pay a tax on, you would end up paying tax on your losses, on your sequestration. So a fairer way of doing it would be to have a sort of 5-year moving average. This is when it comes to the methodology of actually working out how you account for how much carbon you have stored in your trees. We are in discussions with National Treasury and DEA and the consultants on this issue. Next slide. As I mentioned earlier, we're very happy that to store carbon can be done by other industries as well. And I think the cement guys would love it if we could have concrete storing carbon. And I think that he would love to say something about that, but he's not going to, and he hasn't. But we would still be very grateful if there was an explicit statement relating to the inclusion of plantations. We do have our reasons for that. We have felt, although we do a very good job of contributing to the economy and of sequestering carbon, the plantation sector has had great difficulty planting trees because we're very regulated, and some departments don't necessarily like us, so we'd appreciate it if you could still mention us. On tax-free allowances, we're interested to know what would constitute additional measures. That could be an interesting answer to that. Then the next slide. In the current methodology, that where we've been engaging with National Treasury, Department of Environmental Affairs and the consultants, they propose simple lookup tables, but we have pointed out to them that at great cost there has been, and it's in the process of development, a carbon calculator being developed by the University of Stellenbosch, and that we're proposing that actually be mentioned in this methodology, because it's a very simple way, and there's a lot of research that has gone into it. And in fact, we're having a report back on which tier we will be up to tier 2. We'll be able to report tier 2 sequestration with it. From the small and medium growers, it would be particularly useful for carbon offsets, for calculating carbon offsets. Okay, so in closing, the sector contributes 9 billion rand. In 2017, we contributed 9 billion rand to the country's balance of payments, and that off 0.8% of greenhouse gas emissions. It's an unusual way to measure things. The entire value chain, we employ around 150,000 people, from planting trees right the way through. If our sector didn't exist, a lot of rural areas wouldn't have had development, including roads, clinics and schools. And as I mentioned earlier, we do truly appreciate that the S has been included, particularly for the use of offsets. But if the appropriate methodology is not developed, it could well negatively impact our sector. And then the next slide. If it weren't for the pulp and paper industry or the forest product industry operating worldwide for the last 150 years, the CO2 levels in the atmosphere would be 5% higher, so that's half a degree in Celsius, than they are at present, although Professor Lloyd would probably disagree with me there. And then the last slide. Thank you. I'm done.
Okay, questions, comments, please. Sandy, you want to say something?
Chair, I
I've got a special request, and I'm begging for your indulgence. Can I have a direct engagement with the professor before I ask questions to other people? A direct engagement.
Yeah.
Thanks. I want to ask him specific questions and I want him to respond to them. Professor, I want to know whether you, in terms of the literature that you have used, have you either used literature that's come from NASA or is it UMetSat? I'll ask those questions like that, Chair, response and answer.
Chair, I can confirm that I have indeed used NASA data, and I could show her, for instance, the corruption of the NASA data on that first temperature graph. I've got a full monograph on that, and I would be happy to share that with her.
And what's that? Or UK Space Agency?
The big temperature ones are GISS, GHCN, and you'll pardon me for using acronyms, Mr. Chairman, and HADCRUST, the Hadley Climate Research Unit in the US, in Britain. Those are the three major sources of data.
Are they both from Britain?
Well, Hadley is from Britain, and GISS and GHCN are both under NASA wings, separate. One's Goddard Institute of Space Studies, and the other's the Globally Harmonized Climate Network, and both are run by NASA.
Has there been fundamental contradiction between literature produced by NASA and these three institutions?
I have indeed had long communication with them, and you may recall that I reported out that according to them, they had altered our data because they had found out that the station had moved from the observatory to the airport. That is recorded in their...
Chair, the professor is evading my question.
Sorry, I didn't understand your question.
I'm asking whether there is a fundamental...
You're not asking any questions, yes. That's when you have four committees. Right, fine. Okay, can you ask your questions, Tandy? Let's not... there's nobody asking questions.
I'm trying to establish the theory and where it's based.
Yeah, but what he's objecting to is the question-answer format.
I request that in advance.
Yes, I agree to it, but... You know what, I think we must move on because of the time. I don't agree with Mr. Lees, but I'm just asking you to be sensitive, because this is where you are entitled to do it when nobody else is asking questions. It's fine, Tandy, I agree with you, but let's not fight, let's move on.
Yeah, I'm not trying to fight. You see, I'm not intelligent, but I'm trying to think, and I need to understand the basis of...
15:00.
I won't take long, Chair. I'm almost done.
No, it's fine. Okay.
This one to me becomes important, that if the professor tell me whether is there a fundamental contradiction between literature produced by NASA and these three institutions. It's a very easy one, say yes or no.
I'm sorry, between NASA and what other institutions?
And the literature that you use from Britain.
The literature from NASA and the various other institutions is consistent. It's the same, it's all been altered.
Are you funded by any of these institutions in terms of your research work?
By all those institutions, as I say, if you go back to the fundamental, the input information into those databases, it has all been altered, and I can give you chapter and verse on those alterations.
Have you read any alternative literature about... That's the last question.
Yeah, good.
Have you read any literature that relates to tropical cyclones that is different from the one you presented?
Very much, I've read quite widely on the subject of tropical cyclones. If you read the paper that I presented, you will find that there's quite a lot of information in there about tropical cyclones, and one of the problems of the tropical cyclones is that it's only recently we've been able to get a decent idea of what the energy actually is involved in them. So
move on, right. Good, thank you.
Okay, Chair, then I leave the homework to the environmental people to make sense of
your questions to other people. Can you read them quickly?
Let me start with the last presenter in relation to the issue of biomass. I want to know if there's a different emission component that is produced by biomass as opposed to any other emissions that are there. And then let me go to... I'm sorry, Chair, I'm going to ask questions that are not making sense, but they will only make sense to me.
to Deloitte. Do you represent any clients? And if yes, can you please name them and so that we can understand who they are? Chair, I'm going to be slow because you allowed me not to be able to think by putting so many things. In relation to PwC, I need to register my disappointment today that in terms of your presentation as opposed to what you always present, this one doesn't seem that you have applied your mind as you always do. So I'm very disappointed at your presentation. But I want to know whether in relation to vehicle emissions and carbon emissions, you said that there's double taxation. I thought there are different categories of vehicles that should be listed in terms of this specific tax. So did you understand? Because you know why I'm raising this question, Chair. To me, it sounds as if it's either the National Treasury and the NDA never consulted them at all, because their presentation suggests that they know nothing about what has been presented to us. So I don't understand why it doesn't make sense to us and doesn't make sense to anybody. So it means we must go through and from getting the presentations to deal with some of the questions. The other question is, what do you mean by certain qualitative factors to be taken into account in relation to imports? Because you did not mention any of them. You just said so. In terms of geographical limitations of emissions, can you please expand? Because I did not understand whether you were saying that they're using American standards in terms of geographical emissions, and because I hear them speaking specifically to the South African standards set as special. That's why I'm saying, to me, it sounds as if no presentations were made at all. Let me pause and get answers so that I'll come back.
Please answer the questions. Starting with who? In the order you want.
Thanks, Chair. All right. Just in terms of the qualitative factors, what I'm getting at, there are no specifics. What I'm simply saying is that what you can't simply do is use quantitative measures of imports and exports as the sole measure of whether or not your sector is trade exposed. You need to take into account other factors as well. So those other factors, for example, might, let's take the steel sector, which was mentioned earlier as well. You need to consider in relation to those specific sectors whether or not they are at risk of import substitution, having regard to their own particular facts and circumstances and the market in which they operate. So I don't think I can say definitively there are certain specifics, but what I'm saying is that there are other factors that need to be considered in relation to particular sectors, having regard to their own particular circumstances. In relation to the geographical emissions limitations, you're right in the sense that obviously the greenhouse gas reporting regulations, which are in a sense cross-referenced by the legislation, are at least in theory limited to South African emissions. The trouble is that the way in which it is done in the legislation, that only determines whether or not you are, in a sense, liable for the tax. When it comes to actual emissions on which the tax is actually to be levied, there is no geographical limitation in the actual tax legislation itself. So that's where the problem lies. And it's a technical issue rather than a policy issue. I'm not sure if you had a particular question in relation to the vehicle emissions tax, double taxation issue. I didn't quite pick one up there.
I wanted to know whether you understand that there are different categories of vehicles. That's why there'll be a variance.
Yes. Certainly, do you understand the different categories of vehicles? So yes, so it's only applying, the vehicle emissions tax is only applying to passenger vehicles and double cab buckies. But the point is that I was making is in relation to those particular vehicles, they'll be double taxed both in terms of their potential emissions, which is then taxed at the time at which the vehicle is actually purchased, as well as they'll be taxed on their actual emissions based on the fuel which are purchased to run those vehicles. That was the point I was making.
Okay.
Okay, anybody else wants to respond from this cluster? Yes.
Sorry, Isaac Swart from Deloitte. Chair, I think just from the question was if we're representing somebody, we're representing Deloitte's view on the carbon tax bill as we see it. Nobody else.
Okay. Can we draw to a close for this session? There's a 15...
Can I just make a comment on the input of Professor Philip Lloyd? I think it's not for the first time that we come across this submission as a committee. I think Professor Lloyd came to one of our colloquium and to make a similar presentation, and I think most people who are in attendance were not in agreement with him. And I would advise him to engage. You see, the UNFCCC has got a scientific authority, which you are quoting here, IPCC, and which consists of a number of scientists on climate change around the world. And they all have come to a consensus that a phenomenon called climate change exists, that there are rising sea levels, that there are rising temperatures, that there are extreme weather conditions as a result directly of climate change. And that consensus has not been contested internationally. Every year there are climate change conferences, and those are assumptions that we are working on. Even all the climate actions that different countries around the world are taking are based on that scientific consensus. And I did advise the Prof that maybe it's important that he speaks to the IPCC and test his theories with them and see whether there can be some kind of a consensus, but because his underlying assumptions are fundamentally problematic, because the Prof does quote selectively from some of the publication of the IPCC, but those quotations are a bit more selective because it is taken out of context of what the reports are actually seeking to articulate. So that's the comment that I would want to make. The entire world is working under those assumptions that there's climate change and the effects of climate change are being felt now as we speak, and the world needs to do something to reduce or to stop this temperature rising globally. So I just want to make the comment. I know that it's not in agreement with what the Prof is saying, but everybody, almost even the representative of business, do accept that there is something called climate change, and we need to come up with mitigation and adaptation strategies in order to deal with these effects of climate change.
We move on.
May I respond, sir?
Yeah, very quickly, but it's an ongoing debate, yeah.
The speaker may not have been aware of the fact that in 2007 I was nominated by the IPCC as a member of their team to share the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore. I've been a contributor to the IPCC as one of the specialist scientists that they referred to. I have been a referee. I recently refereed the report referred to by Professor Winkler earlier on about 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade. I'm not alone in my rejection of some of these things. There's a chap called Donald Trump who seems to think that the Paris Agreement is nonsense. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
you very much. Just to explain very quickly, we apologize to civil society stakeholders, but our committee's budget is completely depleted because we have endless public hearings, and almost all of them, younger, are you listening, are contested, right? The HPL, now we are here, the VAT increase and so on. So can people be very economical with how much you take for lunch? And if it's of any consolation, we are going to finish at 15:00, so you can have a late lunch. But for now, it's 15 or 20 minutes. Can we give 20 minutes? Yeah. 20 minutes is fine. So we're back here, colleagues, at 2:03. Thank you.
I don't know. I can imagine how the family copes with her. And this if she stays alone, like 1 hour.
You talk too much.
Too much.
Misguided. Yeah. You didn't have it.
It's embarrassing, right?
You didn't have it. No one would
do it. No one would do it. My mom.